There's a legend round here. A killer buried, but not dead. A curse on Crystal Lake. A death curse. Jason Voorhees' curse. They say he died as a boy, but he keeps coming back. Few have seen him and lived. Some have even tried to stop him. No one can. People forget. He's down there, waiting.
Howdy, folks, and welcome to the Friday the 13th Spectacular here on Dead Pit Radio. I am Uncle Bill.
And I'm the creepy Kentuckian, if you will. And like we were saying before, Paramount has shunned the series. They don't really release any special features worth a fuck on their DVD.
Oh, they release box sets, but it's just like little single disc editions of stuff that you already would have if you bought the regular.
I know that the DVDs. Fans, yeah, I mean, the fans of the series are yearning for extras, interviews. You know, they want to know more about the series, and as do we, which is why we started doing these Friday the 13th shows back in 2006, early 2006, and they've definitely become a fan favorite on Dead Pit. We've interviewed almost everyone from the original Friday the 13th, so now we're expanding our horizons. This is a special Friday the 13th dedicated to Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning.
Hey, I know a really good way that you can learn more about the Friday the 13th series. You can check out our commentaries on Friday the 13th Part 1 and Part 5, exclusively for sale now on DeadPit.com.
On the Dead Mart.
Oh, right. You could buy those.
Yeah, and we've been doing those, and, you know, we're not making hardly any money with those. So, you know, it's not about that. It's about supplying the fans with some good quality information when it comes to the Friday the 13th series. But this show is definitely one of our best Friday the 13th shows, I think, as far as interviews go, and rare interviews, you know, to say the least. We have lined up for you, we have Tom Morga, a.k.a. Jason, from Friday the 13th, Part 5. Momentarily, we're going to play that one.
And a little bit later, we'll have the director, Danny Steinman. And after that, we'll, of course, have Junior himself from Part 5, actor Ron Sloan, who was nice enough to do. I'm pretty sure this might be the first audio interviews from both these guys. So.
Yeah, and we'll probably be talking a little bit about the convention, which is coming up. And we actually, Ron Sloan, you know, thankfully is on the guest list now. And seemed really interested in the big Friday the 13th 5 reunion, which is coming up here in a few months. We'll be talking about that in a little bit. But without further ado, we might as well get to our first interview of the trifecta of Friday the 13th Part 5 goodness.
Trifecta of terror.
Yeah, trifecta of horror. Here is Tom Morga, stuntman extraordinaire, on the Friday the 13th Part 5 tribute show here on Dead Pit.
You've been doing stunts for a few years, mainly on big budget films before you were offered the role of Jason in Friday the 13th Part 5. Were you a fan of the series or horror films in general before that?
Well, before that, I wasn't necessarily a fan. I was, of course, I'd seen a few. I wasn't the kind of fan that, you know, would go see every one of them. Mm-hmm. But I had an interest. Of course, doing them changes you a little bit because now you're involved. But I just like a lot of action movies. I like, of course, I'm a stuntman, so I like those kind of things. So any kind of fights and falls and fire and excitement is all cool for me.
Now, how were you approached about the role, and what did they tell you would have to do, and did you do any research about the films?
A little bit, mainly put together a film company. All the departments are heads are hired, and when it comes to stunts, they have what they call a stunt coordinator, who's the head of the department, mm-hmm. and he's interviewed by the producers and selected, and he's the one who then will break down the script and call for the stunt people to be the doubles and for the different stunt action that's in the film. And the stunt coordinator for Friday the 15th Part 5 was Dick Warlock, who had been in Halloween and had played The Shape, and because of his experience with that genre of film, I think that's why they hired him to be the coordinator. He had done lots of other things, of course, and he's a good friend of mine because we're both members of the Stunt Association, and I was about the right size. He told me to come in with several other guys and interview, and what we were to do is give the director a look at the way we might walk and act and be as Jason. So the so-called interview we did was to pretend as if we were laying in a grave and sit up, cross our legs or whatever it took to stand straight up without using our hands, and then walk off like Jason.
Oh.
Well, I guess everyone did that, and I guess he liked the way I did it best because I got hired.
I see.
So I had looked at a couple of the films and checked the way he walked, and it was kind of like just like, hey, well, I remember that. Sure, I could do that. And I guess it was as good as anyone else and good enough for the director, so I got it.
Did you pay attention to any of the previous films more so than the rest, or one particular film you've
No, done? I didn't. Okay. I really didn't. I talked to Ted White, had done the one before me. He's another friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he just had a couple of tips, you know, about nothing real intricate. And I think I had a feel for it. I just, mm-hmm. watching and having been, stuntmen tend to be able to move like an actor, copy people. That's what we do. You know, we're doubles. So it's not a far reach to play a character, and one like Jason, where you move like this, you know, like the character he is. So it wasn't too difficult to pick up.
Now, once you started filming, how many days were you on the set for, if you remember, and what was it like behind the scenes as far as the cast? Did they all get along pretty well? Or?
Yeah, we were there for a couple of weeks, and, you know, to tell you the truth, if the filming schedule was like 3 weeks, I was there a good portion of it. It was on location, and we had to drive about an hour or so from where we were out to the Oxnard location. They had a ranch out there, or a farm that they're working at. And everybody seemed to get along well. All the different cast members, we had some fun with it. It wasn't easy. Of course, doing nights and being wet, and it's always cold, and the conditions aren't real comfortable, and some of the wardrobe that you wear and stuff is makes it a little tough, and, mm-hmm. you know, working nights. But everybody was in pretty good spirits, and everybody seemed to enjoy doing what they were doing and put their heart into it, and we all made the best of it. And Dick Warlock, who is quite a character himself, he's a lot of fun, so he helped make things a lot of fun to do.
Now, I had heard that some people had a problem on the set with the director. Did you ever witness anything, or did you ever have a problem?
I don't know. I didn't have a problem. I don't know anybody particularly who had a problem. Every production you ever do, every movie you're on, there's always difficulties. It's an artistic endeavor. The producers have a show that they're trying to put together, and they have a vision. The director comes in, and he has what he thinks is the way he'd like to create the show. Each actor has their own idea of their character. All these things have to be kind of worked together. Sometimes there's a little bit of conflict between what an actor feels he wants to do and what the director wants him to do.
Yeah.
And that may have happened somewhat on this one, but, you know, I wasn't aware of it. I seemed to get along well with the director and everything we did. Sort of fell in place.
Okay. Also, there's quite a few fight sequences in the film, and I was curious if anyone had any problems with that, if anyone got injured, or if you yourself got injured.
No, that's what a stunt guy does, generally make it safe and make it look real. For instance, we were doing the chainsaw.
Yeah, exactly.
We had a real chainsaw, but we took the blade off. We took the chain off the blade, so we had essentially painted it to look like it had a blade. We were running it with when it's not running, when it's sitting there, it has a chain on it. When I pick it up and start to use it and swing it around, the chain you wouldn't see anyway, so we just had a black tape that would look like a chain as mm-hmm. it was moving, and in the noise and in the flailing with it, there was no chain going around. So things like that that we do to keep things safe is our job, and we were successful that no one was hurt. I don't think we had any injuries to speak of on five, and we did some pretty, you know, some pretty rugged stuff. The hit I took with the front loader, that was all actual. I worked it out with my stunt man who doubled for the kid, and he drove it straight at me at a certain speed. We had rigged the bucket so that I could get my foot and hand in a certain place and I could get a purchase to take the hit and get thrown back,
mm-hmm.
and timing and everything. You know, it hopefully it looked as violent as it should have, and we kept it safe, so no one was hurt.
Yeah, it looked great, yeah.
Now, I'd always felt that the film was one of the most underrated of the series. Looking at the ones that you've seen, how do you think that it ranked amongst the others?
Well, I appreciate that comment. I've heard lots of people say that, you know, this is not really Jason, you know.
Right.
And that's true. The only time I was Jason was a couple of times in, you know, when they were looking at Jason and I had the real mask on. One time I was down by the tree and it was a view from the top window. But I think it holds up as good as any, as far as the action, and heck, there was plenty of frightening moments, and fights were good, and all the stuff that the chasing and crashing through the door and tossing people through the window. I think all that stuff worked good. I think it could be considered as good. And I've had people tell me they liked it best, and I've told people tell me that they thought it was the worst. So it's an opinion, you know.
Yeah, really.
But
yeah.
I think it was good.
Yeah, it's definitely both of our favorites.
Good.
One character I was going to ask you about, though, is one of my favorite characters in any horror film was played by Carol Locatell. Can you have any memories of her who played Ethel in the film?
She was a great character, and she played that thing so well. I didn't have a lot to do with her. All I did is, I think we, you know, stuck the meat cleaver through the window.
Right, yeah.
And but she, I thought, was great, because she just threw herself into this hillbilly thing, and how do you get over here? So she was pretty cool. Although I didn't spend much time, you know, in conversation with her.
Right.
Welcome back to Dead Pit. Big thanks goes out to Tom Morga for taking the time out to do the interview with us.
Woo! Way to go, Tom!
Right.
Tom Morga, you!
Amazing,
buddy.
Woo! Ah, yeah. So, before we get into the interview with Danny Steinman, which is coming up, got some other announcements to make as far as the Dead Pit site goes. We have a lot of Friday the 13th extra features on that site, in addition to just this show. You can check out Uncle Bill's Friday the 13th Retrospective, which is a new Diary of the Dead Pit update in which Uncle Bill dissects every Jason film, Friday the 13th film out there.
Yeah, I did this last week with Nightmare on Elm Street, the franchise of Nightmare on Elm Street. And this week, I decided, since it is Friday the 13th, to go ahead and do it. About 27 minutes long, I think, and I talk about every single movie, which, think about it, there's 11 movies that feature Jason somewhere or other, so to talk about them all, for 2 minutes each, take up about the whole time.
Indeed. And the J-Ray Connection also had a chat with the creators of the Freddy vs. Jason vs. Ash comic book. And they actually met up with those guys a few months ago at the Texas Fear Fest convention in Dallas, Texas, which is also showcasing the Friday 5 reunion, which...
If we talk about it enough, we're liable to get some kind of a pass to go there, I hope. I hope we keep talking about it, somebody will buy us down there.
Well, we all know Jay Reel and Ray Boucher are banned from there.
They're banned for life, like all three
of the guests are going to be there on this show, in addition, like almost everybody from the cast that's still alive. I'm no bullshit. This is like one show that I wish to God I could go to. But unfortunately, it's in fucking Dallas, Texas, which is all the way across the other side of the country. But it's a huge Friday the 13th reunion, also Halloween 4 reunion and a Monster Squad reunion. We're really, you know, they are not associated with this show at all. The guys running that, it's not like that at all. I'm just, you know, trying to help the people out that took the time to do their interviews. And if people want to go meet them and stuff, they can do that. But
you know what I'm really looking forward to, though, is whenever we get the interview with the guy who drew the comic book, Ash versus Jason versus Bub the Chud.
versus Dolly Dearest.
Yeah, I'm really hoping to see that one.
Yeah, and something else that we didn't mention, though, we're actually a little bit later on, after these interviews, we're going to have the fan section like we do in the normal shows, and we're going to be talking about Friday the 13th with the fans of Dead Pit, as well as we're going to have DVD reviews a little bit later that are totally un-Friday the 13th related. But, you know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we did one time where we went through and did like all the Friday the 13th films,
yeah,
like a retrospective of all of them. So I think we've talked pretty much as you can about Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in the next segment we'll talk about the fans' reaction to part 5 and why. It's similar in a little bit, it's similar sort of to the Halloween 3 reaction that it got over the years. Right
now,
people
say we bitch, but seriously, God. Like, we don't bitch about that kind of stuff. I think that kind of stuff, silly. People that go on about Halloween 3 and Friday the 13th part 5,
right,
that's just... And we'll get into it more, I'm sure, later. But it doesn't really make any sense to me.
The stuff that we're reviewing, though, we're actually going through the entire Rambo franchise. This is Rambo, the original trilogy and the new Rambo movie. Pretty cool way we're going to be reviewing these, because I actually reviewed the Blu-ray versions. And in addition to just talking about the movies, I can tell you if it's actually worth purchasing if you're a Blu-ray buyer out there, and just the quality of the movies and stuff like that. And we'll be talking about that one.
Yeah, and then I've actually got the Stallone complete collector set, which is like in a little... It looks like a case that you used to keep your crayons in when you were in kindergarten and stuff. It's like a metal box, and it features all of the Rambo movies and the new, of course, Rambo, including the new Rambo film. And
it's confusing, like we were saying before.
Yeah, but it's also got a collector, like, bonus disc with all kinds of special features.
It's a bonus disc, baby.
And it's got a digital copy in it, which I've never used, but it's in there.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of studios are doing that now.
You can put it on your iPod if I gave it.
I probably never owned an iPod, but, I guess some people like it. But also we're talking about Funny Games, which is an independent movie starring Naomi Watts, which she also produced that movie as well. I think it's a remake from a movie back about 10 years ago that was made, which I'm actually thinking that I might have saw some of that after watching the movie. Maybe it was on IFC or something one time.
Could have been. I've never seen it.
I'm thinking I saw something very close.
I don't know why, but the first time I heard the name of that film, I was thinking about that old horrible movie, Funny Man.
Yeah.
I thought, well, are they going to remake that? That'd be horrible.
Yeah, that movie was horrible. But I guess we might as well get back to our interviews. This next guest, big thanks out to Michael Felcher of Red Shirt Pictures, who's actually working on another movie of Danny Steinman, which we're going to be talking about here on DVD, which is coming from BCI, called Savage Streets. And as far as I know, I haven't talked to Felcher about this, but Steinman actually did mention to us that this one was actually going to be released in Blu-ray as well. So pretty big deal with that. And Danny Steinman, he's sort of an enigma, I guess, because the only other interview I've ever seen with that guy was just for the Crystal Lake Memories book. And I'm pleased to say that we got him on Dead Pit. I was very surprised that we got him, but without the help of old Slippy, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's helped us out more times than I can really remember, so we always got to thank him. But Danny Steinman is a pretty controversial polarizing figure, because if you've read the Crystal Lake Memories book, you realize that there's certain people that worked on that movie that weren't exactly happy with him or the Pace movie, although the people that we talked to didn't have anything bad to say about
him. They always said good things about him, so I don't know if that was just the way they edited the book around, because they had like a whole section in the book, a whole 2 pages talking about, you know, the cast and crew's impressions of Danny Steinman as a person, you know, which is nobody else in the book they did that with. I don't know, but so here is the interview with Danny Steinman on our special Friday the 13th Part 5 look back here on DeadBit.com.
So I guess the first question is, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in directing.
Well, I started off as an actor, and I'm from New York City, so I tried to get some work there. And then I went out to the coast. I did a couple of little things there. And then I went to Spain because there were a whole contingent of American actors working there. Mm-hmm. And films like Dr. Zhivago and El Cid, and, you know, big films that they shot in Spain for like probably half the price. So I went there and I became part of that that stock company. Like I was in the Battle of the Bulge, and one day I was a German, the next day I was a GI, you know, that type of thing. And I got the lead in a movie called Hallucination Generation.
Okay.
And my father and some of his friends financed it, so I'm sure that didn't influence me getting the lead, I'm sure, you know, because I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Anyway, that picture got made, and it was about acid. It was about 64, 65, I think. And AIP bought it, American International Pictures, because they wanted to just store it away someplace, because they had a picture called The Trip that was coming out. And it did pretty well with Peter Fonda and stuff, so I'd never seen the film. Anyway, when I got back from Spain, I went to I got a job at a toy commercial production house. And the guy I owned it, took me under his wing, and I learned about the camera and lighting and cutting and editing stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, one day I went to downtown to New York City and saw that Deep Throat was playing. I had heard about it. It was about 2 months out.
Right.
And I think it was like the second hardcore film that was made. First one was Mona. It was the first feature that was shown in New York. I know it was totally hardcore. So I directed this film called High Rise, which was a hardcore film. Because I had that studio that was shooting these toy commercials, and I made a deal with a guy. So they had sets and a whole crew there. So I wrote this film, High Rise. It was pretty fast. I mean, the whole thing took me 2.5 days to shoot. But I prepped it for about, I think, a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I made a lot of money off the film. And, you know, it's... It was quite an experience.
So you'd never really watched any... nobody was over you directing that? That was just a first-time thing for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had the skills from watching them shoot these toy commercials, and after a while, I directed a whole bunch of them, too.
How is it that you exactly transitioned from that into the unseen?
Well, that's... Let me go through it so you'll understand.
Okay.
I went down to Puerto Rico, shot commercials down there, and they had 10 years tax-free status, so it really was cheap to shoot commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this friend who was an advertising director from House of Pancakes and House of Pies. And they came down, and I shot two of those 30-second commercials, which were shown that year on the Super Bowl. And...
Then I went to work for Gene Roddenberry from Star Trek.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I was with him for a couple, 2.5 years. I was like his right-hand man, associate producer. Huh. And we shot a film in London called Spectra with Robert Culp.
Mm-hmm.
Not too good a film. Clive Donner was the director. But I was picking up things as, you know, associate producer is a terrific job to have. If you want to get near the director and you want to do anything you want, as far as asking the lighting man, what's this, and how does that work, and looking in the camera every now and then.
Yeah.
So, okay, about this time, I spent a lot of time, you know, writing stuff and everything. And so I wrote The Unseen, and I got it together. It was happening. Barbara Bach was in it.
Right.
Yeah, that's Ringo's wife. And I took my name off the film. And, I didn't know about it, but they hired an editor while I was shooting to cut the film, you know, day by day. He was making a rough cut as I was shooting. They thought they had such a winner there. They rushed to sell the film in Cannes, the festival there, because they wanted to get all the markets and everything. So I had no cut. I'm sorry. What?
That's okay. Does the film exist? Like, is there another cut of the film that exists?
Yeah. I saw a bit of it on when the first cable channels begun. USA was showing it like twice a week, so I think that's about all.
Right. I know that the DVD of that, they're working on the DVD of that right now. Do you know if it's the uncut version?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea.
So,
were
you a fan of horror films?
Yeah, I love horror films. I mean, The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby, I don't know if you saw them, those are two of my favorite films still.
Oh, yeah.
To this day, just fantastic films. I remember seeing The Exorcist in the city, in New York City, lines around the corner, and the first time I saw it, the audience was so revolted. I mean, just they were so, like in shock. I've never seen it. The closest I saw was when Psycho came out and that shower scene happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, Linda Blair was on that, and she turned out to be on Savage Streets, which I did.
Yeah, I thought that would be an interesting segue. So how is it that you actually...
Well, let me just finish about The Unseen. So the guy missed all the jumps, all the scare moments in the film, the editor. So, I mean, that's when I took my name off the film, and I really came close to burning down the fucking building with all the footage restored. I mean, I really came close.
Right.
And I'm telling you, there was a good film there. You know, you can't say it. You say that to anybody because it's done. What it is, you know.
Well, I mean, hopefully if they have the print, maybe the new DVD will be the.
No, the motherfuckers, these guys. I still hold the hate in my heart for that.
Yeah.
You know, because even when you do a film, even if it's a small Picasso film, you know, you're not. It's yours, and you don't want to. You at least want to. Finish it, you know, and put in the music and make the film work the way I shot it, you know.
So, we're talking about Savage Streets, though. I think you replaced Tom DeSimone as the director of the film, but were you always the writer?
Well, a producer friend of mine called me and said he just fired, I guess, DeSimone. This is the day before principal photography was going to begin on Savage Streets. So, would I be interested? And of course, I said I did. You know, wanted to do it. So I went over to his office, and a lot of the crew and the cast were there. And I read the script that afternoon, and it was really a piece of shit. I mean, really, just characters and the plot, and I mean, just made no sense. I thought, you know. So, I was basically told to do what I thought would make a better film.
Wow.
And so it gave me, you know, carte blanche really to do what I wanted. So we wrote, lost some of the characters throughout some of the scenes which so I thought it really didn't work, and just cut a lot and added a lot. But most importantly, I added some scenes which had naked girls in it. That's a priority with me in anything I do.
Yeah, that's a good idea, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, we seem to like that about your movies, so.
Say what?
So we both seem to like that about your movies in particular.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that's appreciated.
I want to ask you about the nudity in the film, though. Was there ever any problem with any of the actresses trying to get them to do all that?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially there was one girl with beautiful tits, and I begged her, you know, because most of them just took off their bras and it was fine, you know.
Yeah.
But she said, no, it's not right for my career, I can't do it. So she didn't. And the next year, I saw her totally naked in a film. In a cheaper film. I mean, if you can get a cheaper film than Savage Streets. So, you know.
You think maybe they paid her more or something like that?
Yeah, maybe.
So
when I was shooting, it was mostly from the hip. You know, but I... You know, I was having a good time, so. But then, I don't know if you heard part of the story, but everybody's checks bounced.
No.
After about 10 days, and the production was shut down. You didn't hear about that?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's how I got to do Friday, you know, because that's where I said, let's back up.
Yeah.
What happened was, what am I up to?
The checks bounced.
Checks bounced, yeah. So, I think the problem was, if I understood the politics of it, was that it wasn't clear in the beginning who owned what. Who were the producers? I mean, at one point there were like 7-8 producers, you know, or people calling themselves producers. And the mob money was either partly or mostly... It came from them, so they were super pissed, you know. And so they try to hold everything together. And the producers, two producers, a woman and her husband—I forgot their names—offered me some good money and a beautiful two-story apartment on the beach in the marina, and a car to stay with it, you know, to because they said they're going to make it happen, you know. Right. So, I mean, that's basically where I met the two investors from Friday, who financed Friday.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the cast from Savage Streets, though, like Linda Blair and John Vernon and Linnea Quigley. Do you have any memories working with them?
Well, Linnea and Linda, really, I mean, anything I asked them to do, they did. I mean, and Linnea, there's a rape scene in that, which she really, really put up, you know, with a lot, and with a smile, with good humor. I just thought she was terrific. And Linda, when I asked her to be naked in the tub.
Yeah.
She did it. I mean, no problem. You know, I said, well, I'll just have four people in the crew there and, you know. Sorry. And she was terrific. So, and John Vernon, I cut his part because it was repetitive and there was a whole subplot with he and his family, you know, nothing to do with the film. And I wanted to keep it moving. You know, even if it didn't make sense, I wanted to keep the story, the visuals, you know, kind of interesting. So, yeah, I think he had two scenes, which he was paid like they had made a deal with him to work for 5 days or 6 days. I lost him. I let him go at, you know, it was half a day, I think. And he came up with a couple lines that were his, like, go fuck an iceberg.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about.
I mean, what the hell does that mean?
It's genius stuff.
Yeah.
Just the way he delivered it.
Yeah, he's a wild guy, yeah. No, I liked him. And, no, but I really never had any problem with any of the cast. They were, you know, they were excited to be working. except for that one fucking girl, you know. Cause,
yeah.
And when I saw the film of her naked, those tits were unbelievable. I mean, they were perfect. And pre-silicon, you know, so they're real, you know.
Right.
And am I on too much of tits? And
oh, no, we're definitely one girl I want to ask you about in the Friday the 13th 5 as well.
Okay, we'll get to that.
So we'll get to that.
I think I know which one.
Yeah, it's hard to miss.
Well, by the way, on Savage Streets, I just did it's coming out in September in high definition, and I just did a commentary, and Linda Blair did one, too. I mean, I have no money interest. I mean, I couldn't give a shit if anybody buys it or not. Could care less, so, but just anybody who's interested in a piece of trash film from the 80s, you know, with
Michael Pelcher recorded your commentary and stuff.
Right, yeah. Very nice guy.
One other quick thing about Savage Streets was the soundtrack to the movie, and a lot of people seem to love the music in the film, and it was, I don't think it was ever released on CD, do you know?
No idea.
If, you don't know if it's ever going to be re-released.
No idea. I think they made a deal, the music deal, before I got there. So, okay. I'm not sure. Okay. Michael was saying that something about the soundtrack, but I forgot. So anyway, what the hell are we on? Savage Streets.
Yeah.
Let me just finish with that because it's interesting. I told you Mob, back to film, partly back to film.
Right, yeah.
And during this time, when everybody was, like, separated from the film, the guy who initially hired me, fired me, because I guess I took what that couple offered me, you know, the apartment and everything, and he I guess was fighting them. So like 2 days later, a dead fish was left at his front door.
Oh God!
And he bowed out, of course, that day.
Yeah, that's very Godfather-ish right there.
Yeah, you don't fuck with those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, right. You just don't do it here. So what happened about the financing, to get more financing to finish the film, they asked me to meet with these backers to explain about the story, how it would evolve and end, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they saw the footage also. And I didn't know it at the time, but the money behind Friday the 13th, they were the money behind Friday the 13th. And after Savage Streets, they asked me to rewrite and direct Friday 5. So that's how that happened.
Now, do you know who was originally in charge of the movie Friday the 13th 5?
Oh, Frank Mancuso Jr.
Okay.
Yeah, terrific, terrific producer. He's a big producer today. There's a lot of important films.
So, were you familiar with the previous Friday the 13th films before?
I saw Friday 4.
Okay.
Yeah. And they told me to, they told me finally they killed off Jason. Jason was no more, so, it doesn't make sense because Friday 6, what they did is forgot about what happened on Friday 5 and then just continued with their story as if nothing happened.
Yeah.
So I knew the story that Tommy Feldman played him.
Tommy Jarvis character, Corey Feldman?
Yeah, right. That he was going to become, this is what they're, the gimmick was, he was going to become the next Jason. So that, you know, and I had to work that in, that someone's pretending to be Jason, and then at the end he finally turns into Jason.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you got to shoot fast and keep the scenes short so that people don't pay too much attention to what's going on with the story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, so what's your question?
Those were the main changes that you had to make because you had to write around the fact that Feldman,
yep,
initially what they wanted to do was have the Tommy character as the killer, but you had to change that. So what made
I worked him into it. I mean, you can't just become Jason.
Right. So at the very end, at the very end, that's when he gets out of bed and you see him behind the woman. And then, as I said, Friday 6th, there was no problem with just starting over again. That's basically what they did.
Yeah. And they seem to do that after all the movies, after that point, I think, so.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But I did have a lot of trouble with the MPAA as far as what they'd allow and wouldn't allow. So, I mean, there was like 47 seconds of film that they took out, you know, that we fought over. And I think it really took a lot of the edge off the film because, you know, to do the stunts, you know, the gags, you know, someone putting a flare in his mouth and that type of thing, mm-hmm. takes a night, takes a whole night. I mean, you know, you just can't do it fast, you know.
But I got to ask, though, because I've seen some pictures of the uncensored scenes. Does that material still exist, the uncut death scenes and stuff?
I really don't know. I don't think in a film like this they hold on to all the footage.
Yeah.
You know, because. But I mean, the guy with the talking about a magazine, the guy with an axe in his head or a cleaver in his head.
Yeah.
It was the cover of Phantasmagoria. Is that the name of the film, the magazine?
Yeah, Fangoria.
Say it again.
Was it just Fangoria?
Fangoria, probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, all that was just completely cut from the film. You just all you see is an axe coming through frame, and him reacting to it. His mouth goes open, then cut to the house. You know, so. Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of stomach stabs in the movie. Is that like alternate death shots that you shot at the time?
Two were.
Okay.
Yeah. And. But what pissed me off the most, I shot a scene where Jason was in the woods and it's raining. He's following somebody, I forgot who. And there's this little Labrador dog that's cold and it's shivering, and he approaches Jason. And, you know, Jason kind of puts his head to the side. And he scoops the dog up, starts to pet him a few times. And then takes his head in one hand and his tail in the other, and just rips him apart. And then they throw down the dog, and he throws down the dog, and he stomps on it, you know. And they made me take out the whole scene. I couldn't believe it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm fucking with you guys. I'm just fucking with you.
God, I was going to say, I completely understand why that's.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to see it. I go.
Yeah, I do. I gotta ask, what is the thing with Tom D. Simone? Because he appears either in, you know, in like Savage Streets, and his brother's in Friday Five, and
yeah, I didn't know that was his brother, but he's a terrific guy, Bob, right?
Yeah, Bob.
Yeah. I mean, if I had shot more films, I would have used him again. I thought he was funny. I thought he could do, you know, anything he asked him to do. As a matter of fact, there was one scene in Savage Streets where he plays the teacher, and I had to redo the whole scene because I had him play it comically, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you're doing a story about a girl, a mute girl, who's raped and almost dies. Another girl's thrown over, she's about to get married and thrown over a bridge. And at the same time, you got all this fluff, all the, you know, the girly stuff and all the, you know, I mean, it's all mixed in together, you know.
Right.
So it's tough to keep a balance. And again, I mean, that's why I wanted to shoot as many scenes as I could, so it moved, and as many exploitation moments as I could.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Talk about some of the actresses in Friday the 13th Five, like Melanie Kahneman, and of course Debbie Sue Voorhees, who is my personal favorite girl in like all the Friday the 13th movies. I gotta say,
yeah, me too. She, you know, in Dallas, I think in early October they're having a convention of Friday Five and Halloween Four and another film, and the guy who's
producing it, or make the guy was making it happen, told me that he contacted Deborah Voorhees. Is that who?
Yeah.
Deborah
was, and she's a housewife. She lives right outside Dallas, and you know, plenty of kids. All these girls are they're in their mid forties, or you know, going through menopause. You know, so you got to keep that in mind. And no, but she was terrific. I mean, just the greatest. I hate to mention names, but just the most beautiful body. You know, I would have loved to have been there. She was just terrific. It's kind of amazing that her last name is Voorhees, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, or else she made it up to get the part, you know, or something.
Now, what do you remember about the atmosphere on the set? Did everybody get along with their cliques, stuff like that?
Now a picture like this, which is shot in like 27 days, and certain actors are in a scene, and then you never see them again. So people really didn't have a time to gel and to, you know, mix together and everything, because mostly, you know, a character shows up and they're killed off, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, I always thought a story focused on Jason, you know, might be interesting. Does he have any friends? You know, what does he like to eat? Does he jerk off? You know, get to know him. And I should pose that to. Are they all through now with the Fridays?
No, they're making a remake now.
Yeah, they're actually starting them all over again. So.
Terrific.
I was just going to ask about another favorite, actually just a character actor in the movie played by Carol Locatell, who played Ethel. If you have any memories working with her.
Yeah, nice lady. I remember, you know, I had lunch with her all the time, and she was sweet as sugar. No, there was no problems at all. I mean, at all with any of the cast. No one put up a hissy fit or any kind of. There was no ego involved, you know. But like part of the MPAA, which tells you what to leave in and what you can leave in and what you have to pull out. The guy on the bike, I had a terrific close-up of him with the axe slicing his head while he was driving a bike. You know, just a full close-up.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was terrific, and they made me take it out. So all you see really is him on the bike and an axe going through the air and his head on the ground. And, you know, they let me stay on the head maybe for a second. Then you take it out. But they constantly change. Like today, all these movies that I see, you know, like the Saw movies, how do you pronounce that? Hostel?
Yeah.
Hostel, yeah. I mean, they're so graphic, you know, they're unbelievable.
But I want to ask you, too, about just the way people perceive the film now. What do you think about the fans reacting to the film? Because a lot of people say it's not really Jason, so it's not really a Friday film.
If it was Jason or not, the kills would, you know, basically be the same. But if you're saying the audience knows beforehand that it's not Jason, does it make a difference? I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, I never really thought it did, but
yeah, I mean, we often defend the movie just because the only reason people sort of rag on it is the fact that it's not Jason. I mean, to me, what makes it a great slasher movie is, you know, a lot of good death scenes and a lot of hot women, you know. So
yeah, that's what I like. Terrific. I appreciate that.
No problem. Something I was always curious about, though, is just probably no one else even cares about this, but I've always wanted to know, what was with the changes to the mask design? Was that intentional, or was that just something that, you know?
It looked different. I had no idea.
You
mean his mask looks different than the other films?
Yeah, it's there's a different triangle design on it. It's like a different color.
Hmm.
Was that always, I guess, not on your end, but did the producers just want to make the mask look different?
I don't think so. I think it just happened and no one said anything. But, see, there were no fanatic. I didn't sense any fanatic audience, you know, overseeing the film, or you got to do it this way, or no, it looks this way in the original, and he already did that, and or you know, whatever. It was basically just shoot a film, shoot it the best you could. So that's that.
Now, were you pleased with the finished film? I know that you've had problems with The Unseen.
Right. Well, Friday was a great experience. I mean, the producer was terrific, and everybody left me alone, and it was a very, very enjoyable film, especially after Savage Streets, which was like, what happened was, after they found the money and they got their shit together, they attached the producer to the production, and the motherfucker was like a producer from hell. I mean, he tried to take over the film. He tried to do everyone's jobs. He interfered. A lot of tension on the set.
Yeah.
And so basically, I told him to go fuck himself. But he stayed around, and I always felt his presence. But other than Savage Streets, I think my experience being around film and productions, I had a whole bunch of jobs in Europe, which I really loved. And
I heard a story about that you were involved in a Last House on the Left sequel. Is that true?
Yeah, I was hired to do five films after Friday the 13th, and they each, one reason or another, dropped out. The guys who financed Friday, they paid me to write and direct Last House on the Left, and I believe that their rights, they didn't really have their rights secured, so the picture wasn't made.
Now, looking at the movies you made, though, was, you know, when you set out wanting to become a filmmaker, were those the type of movies that you wanted to make, or was there another genre that you wanted to hit?
I had a children's story, which I wanted to do right in the beginning, and it was terrific. I mean, couldn't get the financing for it. And I constantly try to go back to it, but, you know, to get it on again, but I never could.
Yeah.
You know, so, from toy commercials to porno to children's films, who is this man?
Well, the big question is after Friday 13th 5,
yeah,
there's not, I mean, like on IMDb or anything, there's no credits listed. Did you actually return to directing aside from the films that you mentioned that got kind of...
No, I mean, it was so frustrating, I can't tell you, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you got it in you, when you want to do something, you know, whether it's in film or education, painting, whatever, and you just have to do it to really feel fulfilled. And you get there, and you think it's going to happen, and then when it collapses, each time you get more depressed about it. So, and then my accident was in '94, so I had 10 years of those kind of bad luck. So, but as I said, I did work on films, and I enjoyed that, you know, on somebody else's film.
Yeah.
Now, would you ever entertain a opportunity of going back to directing at some point, or is that pretty much
too old?
Okay.
I mean, you got to have physical stamina, you know, especially after my accident. I mean, that really, you know, destroyed me.
Right.
Which is boring.
But now, you mentioned the convention that you're going to be attending. I think it's in October.
Yeah, right, in October.
What do you think, though, about just the fans' interest or re-interest in Friday the 13th 5 enough for, you know, a reunion convention? And are you looking forward to seeing some of these people I'm sure you haven't seen in 20 years or so?
Yeah, 25 years, yeah. No, it'll be fun. It's a real reunion, you know, and I liked all those people. And they were good. I don't think anybody really did a bad job, you know. And I shot, my film ratio was low. I mean, I didn't have to shoot 10 takes on anybody.
Yeah.
You know, everybody more or less got it, you know, 2-1 or 3-1, you know, so.
Now, have you ever been to a convention or?
Never.
Oh,
never.
So you don't really know what to expect with this.
Well, I know what Gene Roddenberry's conventions were like. I just couldn't believe that, you know. So hopefully it's not that over the top.
I
don't know if it's as bad as the Star Trek stuff, but, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm curious to see what it's like, and I'm really flattered that, you know, someone gives a shit. You know, so.
Yeah, lots of people do, man.
Yeah, well, that's super.
John Carl Beekler, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Big thanks there to Danny Steinman for the interview. Like we said, it's one of the only interviews, one of the only audio interviews I know of that he's ever done, and we were really happy to have him. It was like a big catch for us to get him on the show. So,
yeah, I mean, big thanks out for him to do the interview again, and you know, some of the stuff that we've been able to accomplish doing this show was pretty amazing, I think. I mean, it's even to me thinking about it, because a lot of these people, when we were back and doing, like, before we, a lot of people may not know, before we were doing Dead Pit, we were doing these, we did this site called Horror Graphs, where we would supply the fans with contact info for, you know, I would say big name horror celebrities and then the obscure horror celebrities. And there was always a group of people that we were never, ever able to find. And through doing this show, we found almost all of them. I think there's one big one left for you that we haven't got one contact for.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to work on that. And, you know, if the day comes when Jackie Kong is a special guest on Dead Pit, then you'll know that pretty much everyone that we've ever wanted to get on the show that's still live, we've been able to get.
Well, it's like, I don't mean to toot our own horn or anything, but it's almost like we're the horror version of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. I mean, we make dreams come true for everybody, right, including ourselves.
Well, and a lot of it is, too, is these people usually, like I know that some of the people that we've sort of unearthed from obscurity, Madman being one for sure, that they are really just happy to talk about their experiences on the movie, whatever movie it is. And it's not like, usually, like, some people are just thinking maybe they're not out there because they don't want anything to do with, you know, said movie or whatever. But that's usually not the case. The thing is, they just don't know anybody cares. So it's just been a great experience doing interviews like this, and like the one we have coming up with Ron Sloan, which, you know, we found the guy through old-fashioned, you know, stalking techniques we used at the Horror Graphs.
Right.
And
tried true methods.
You know, it's not a good idea.
Personal surveillance.
It's never a good idea to call somebody at their home, usually. But we've done it a few times, and it's worked almost every time for us. But before we get to the Ron Sloan interview, which actually wraps up this special edition as far as the interviews go of Dead Pit, I just wanted to talk about Friday the 13th 5 a little bit, about the fan reaction to the movie and why for so many years people labeled it as the worst Friday the 13th film. And I think finally, with the help of the fans, just the hardcore Friday the 13th fans, and shows like Dead Pit and other shows that are willing to, other conventions that are giving Part 5 the appreciation I think it deserves. I think it's finally getting out of that. But for many years, we know the reason, the main reason, is the plot in the movie. It's not Jason killing.
Well, I'll tell you another reason why I think that a lot of people hate this movie so much is because this movie is the only movie that I think really completely revels in all the things that people hated about Friday the 13th movies in general. Like gratuitous nudity and just mindless violence. Like all the things people claim were completely disintegrating the youth of America. It takes all those and like amplifies them 10 times, and that's all the movie is. Which is great. If you go into a horror movie, that's exactly what you want to see anyway. But for some people, it just made, like, it further kind of put pushed into the spotlight what these movies were all about.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's a lot of horror fans out there, and there's a lot, but there's a select group of horror fans that they don't have any sort of sense of humor about them. They don't want to see a film that's sort of tongue-in-cheek and it's sort of a movie that you can enjoy with friends. There's a lot of horror fans out there that, you know, not to offend anybody that's listening, but they're pretty scary. You know, they want 100% serious horror film at all times.
Right. You know? You've seen them. Most of the people that I know like that are too, the ones that love to watch, like, Faces of Death.
Yeah.
And the August Underground movies and fucking just absolutely detest anything that has comedy in it.
And that's not us. I mean, if you listen to our show, and hopefully there's a lot of new people out there listening to this show just because of what it is.
Like you listen to Dying Fetus.
Yeah. You'll realize that this show is, above anything else, it's an entertainment show more than anything else, I think. I mean, we throw comedy out there more than we do horror news right. Most of the time.
It's like a variety show.
It is, really, yeah, because we have songs.
Like the Smothers Brothers or something.
Yeah. And occasionally, you know, we'll talk about finger-fucking some, you know, females.
Mm-hmm.
And then pulling their finger out and then, like,
yeah,
licking
them. That's our new gimmick, is we're going to pull up beside some woman, make her stick her own thumb up her butt, then lick it off.
Pull it off and suck on her thumb a little while. Just to be a little graphic. But, see, the thing is, the Friday 13th movies, I think that besides Part 5, you know, a lot of them are tongue-in-cheek, especially after Part 5. So
yeah, Part 6 is basically a fucking comedy, really. It's so, like a fantasy comedy movie.
Yeah, I mean, the strict, hardcore, you know, brutal horror fans probably aren't going to like the Friday the 13th series too much anyway. So, but anyway, I guess on to the final interview. We talked about Friday the 13th 5 a little bit. I mean, we've done these retrospectives. You know, you just did another retrospective on Friday the 13th. We've talked about them before in our Friday the 13th spectaculars in the past.
Yeah, but before we get on this interview, I just want to say that one day, we will get the missing counterpart to all these interviews, which is Ethel.
Yeah.
Carol Oaktail on this fucking show.
Oh, and believe me when I tell you, we tried. I mean, we try every time we have a Friday the 13th show to get her on the show.
Yeah.
You know, they say that she's really busy still to this day. I don't know if that's the case or if she just really doesn't want to do any
interviews
related.
She might just be really busy ignoring people that want to do interviews about Friday the 13th.
That could be the case. So, we don't have Ethel, but we do have Junior. So, Ron Sloan, a.k.a. Junior Hubbard, makes his horror talk radio debut, and how fitting that it's on deadpit.com.
They hurt me, Mama. They hurt me real bad.
First question is, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in acting.
I actually started out as a page at Metro Media Television, Channel 11 in Hollywood. And I was a page as the guy who sits the audiences down. And I worked for the Norman Lear shows. So I did All in the Family, Different Strokes, Back to Life, One Day at a Time, all the Lear shows.
Right.
I got to work the audience, and which was really a really good benefit as an actor because I got to watch all the top actors from those sitcoms perform and actually became friends with a couple of them. And that's how I got my union card and got into acting. I was actually on the Steve Allen show. It was called Steve Allen's Laugh Back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really great experience. Steve actually gave me my break on the show, and which qualified me for the union, and that's how I got in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was in a Shakespearean repertory company, Will Gear's Theatricum Botanicum, which, if you guys remember, or maybe not, Will Gear was Grandpa Walton on TV.
Oh yeah.
Walton's Mountain. So it was a beautiful country setting out in the heart of Topanga Canyon. And so I was doing both at the same time, performing theater on weekends and working at the studios during the week.
Cool. Now, before we get started talking about Friday the 13th 5, were you familiar with the previous films before you got cast as Junior?
I knew I was friends with John Puri I think he was in the first one. But I mean, it wasn't like, it was so funny because when I auditioned for the film, they didn't tell us it was Friday the 13th.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it was called Repetition.
Yeah, I heard that was like the working title of the film. I was actually going to ask you about the audition process for the role, too. I've always been kind of curious about how that went.
Yeah, no problem.
So, first of all, who was there in the audition? Who auditioned you, and what did they have you do?
Well, it was interesting because I was actually doing a showcase. I used to do a couple showcases a week where you do a little three-minute scene for casting people. And the casting director, Pamela Basker and Fern Champion, saw me in the showcase and asked me to come to audition for Danny Steinman and Frank Mancuso Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met up with them. I went through like a series of a couple, three auditions, and I just had fun. You know, that's the main thing. I just had fun, and it was a blast, and I got the role. And what was really kind of interesting was, like I said, it was called Repetition, so I had no clue. And they didn't give us full scripts. At least they didn't give me a full script at the time.
Yeah.
They only gave me my sides, you know, just my lines. And it wasn't until basically I got on the set that they gave us the full script because it was such a closed set and really under-the-radar type project. So it was very cool. Once we all, I remember most of the cast, we were sitting around, and all of a sudden we saw Jason walk by, and it was a really kind of a unique moment because we all kind of looked at each other and went, oh, my God.
Yeah.
We're in Friday the 13th. It was fun. I mean, it was like, from that point on, it was fun just getting the role and being excited as an actor, finally getting a break. But to all of a sudden realize, hey, this is very cool. So that was an exciting moment. And really nice group of people. I mean, truly a fun group of people.
Talk about though how you developed the character of Junior. Because I know Carol Locatell, who said that in the Crystal Lake Memories book that a lot of her lines were improv and all that. How about on your end? Was that strictly scripted, your character?
Well, no, there was a basic script, but you know, you did have leeway to, you know, emphasize and just, you know, whatever you came up with. What was really cool was Danny Steinman, the director, you know, he gave us a lot of freedom and you know, good direction. And I don't know, I just had fun with the character. I mean, actually, at that point in my life, I had just gone through almost 3 years of method acting, which mm-hmm. you know, you'd never think you'd utilize that for a character like Junior. But I really did a lot of intense work just to try a whole different person other than myself, and it was a lot of fun.
And
it's just something that I truly dug deep in, especially in, I know it sounds crazy, but scenes like where I'm crying and I remember I'm driving, excuse the dogs, or
okay.
Timberwolves, no, I'm driving through the forest. In order to reproduce that take after take after take, you know, what can make someone scream and cry? And for me, on the motorcycle, I was riding through method acting. I was utilizing the gray of the gas tank, which reminded me it was exactly the same color as the gray of my grandfather's casket. So if I just substituted that color and thought of that, my grandfather being dead, that's how all the fear and emotion came up in me.
Now, I have to ask, a lot of people who I know use method have like an autobiography for their character. Did you do that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, I think it's called Seven Keys. I had my 7 points down that could trigger emotion in me. But, you know, when it really comes down to it, it was just fun. It was just fun. And it's like, you just get into it, and you're just that character, and you just, I mean, it wasn't anything that was like rocket science. It was just, I had a blast. I looked forward, I would love to do it every day. I mean, truly, looking back on it, it was such a special moment in my life. Matter of fact, that whole year, it just, things fell into place.
Mm-hmm. We definitely need to ask you, though, about memories with Carol Lugardo, who played your mother, Ethel, in the movie. And you all definitely made a good on-screen mother-son tandem, I guess.
I saw her not too long ago. Neat lady. I mean, truly a neat lady. And, you know, we're sitting in a farmhouse. I don't know if you're familiar where this was shot.
No, we're not.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, it was in Santa Cruz Canyon. I'm sorry, Santa Rosa Canyon out in Camarillo, California. Okay. And it was a really neat old farmhouse. I mean, this was not a movie set. This was a real place. And orange orchards. And, I mean, it was really an awesome old farm. And Carol and I bonded pretty quickly, you know, because we'd run lines together and just kind of work together. And we had just a blast. And very supportive of each other. And so it was just that sort of thing. Very professional lady.
I imagine that she wasn't that animated when she was away from the role, was she? I mean,
I can honestly tell you, I couldn't tell you the difference.
Really?
She was in character pretty much the whole time, but, you know, I'm kind of kidding around. I mean, she was a sweetheart. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of have to ask yourself, is this really happening?
Yeah.
You know, when you get to be something that you're normally not, you have so much fun, and you just go with it.
Now, another
guy. And there's no boundaries.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could do anything I want with Junior. And I think Carol felt the same way. Her little added touch of spitting in the stew, you know, that was her idea. The hard part was eating it, taking it. But
another guy, though, I wanted to ask you about was, of course, John Shepherd. You had the big fight scene with him toward the middle of the movie.
Oh, my God. I actually got knocked out cold in that scene.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. It looks pretty, I don't know, is there any...
Looks pretty steel.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, actually I got knocked out twice in that scene. First was with the stunt man. There was a stunt double for both of us. And it was just the idea of rehearsing and showing how to fight.
Mm-hmm.
The doubles would show us, and then they'd work with us. And the stunt man knocked me out. He was supposed to miss me. He knocked me out. But then when John and I were fighting, John did connect, and I did go down for the count. And, it does look real because it is.
Yeah.
And we definitely talk about your death scene in the movie. And I believe Danny Steinman, when we talked to him, he had said that they'd cut a lot of that scene out. Do you remember?
The details? Yeah. Well, what had happened was, first of all, just doing that scene was really interesting because it's done in reverse. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they took the blade and they cut a hole in the blade and they placed it up to your neck. And I'm in a wired harness where they'll push a button and it jerks you backwards.
Right.
So what it really is when they reverse the film, it looks like the axe is going in, or the meat cleaver is going into your neck, and you're being thrown forward, and then the head rolls on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole thing was, when the head rolled on the ground, because I got to see the supposedly final cut, I had to do some voiceover looping because of the screaming and all that. And when the head initially rolled on the ground, it rolled so perfectly, it actually stopped looking right up at the camera. And it was so real looking. It freaked me out when I saw it. And doing the ADR voiceover looping.
I'd imagine, though, they did like a head mold.
Oh, the head was actually a nightmare to make. They do it where they wrap your head in like it's like a plasticine. They make a rubber mold.
Right.
So I had to keep my mouth open. And they put little straws in your nose, and they cover you with this like plaster, and fill it with this plastic. I mean, it took about 2 hours to make, and it goes from ice cold margarita headache to real warm suffocation. So the expression on the head is the terror is real. I'd never do it again. And ironically, I have the head.
I was going to ask if you kept any of the props or anything.
Well, they didn't give it to me at the time. They wouldn't let you have anything. I mean, everything was definitely, it was theirs. But 5 years later, I was auditioning for a show down at a studio, and I saw a company sign that said Real Effects, and that was the company that made my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there, and I started talking with the guy, and it was funny. I was telling him, I was in Friday the 13th, and, is there any possibility I could get my head? What a question. And the guy said, you know what? Your head's been working more than you have. And it was so cool because he started walking me down these little corridors, and it was like all monsters and body parts, torsos. I mean, it was all really gruesome-looking stuff, shelf after shelf. I mean, all sorts of really wild-looking things. And there on this top shelf, my head is sitting, and it was like right by a kind of like a bust of Sylvester Stallone from Rambo. I go, and he grabs the head, and he goes, I got to apologize. We blew off the back of your head in the movie last week. Like half the head's gone in the back. So he took it, put it in a bag, and he said, here, enjoy. It's kind of funny. I mean, I was so excited, and I'm like walking through the studio, and here I got this head in a bag, and they had just used it. So, I mean, it was pretty gory looking. It had some like Karo syrup on it to look like blood. As I was leaving the studio, I see Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was making a movie there, and I was walking up to him. I thought, wow, I'm going to say hi to him. And I'm thinking, dude, you got a head in the bag. Security might not appreciate that. You know, I didn't want to. I was feeling like, wow, it was a little overwhelming. So I left. It was just funny. And we've used the head every year during Halloween in some way, shape, or form. That's cool. I mean, 1 year we had it on a silver platter with garnish, and we use it definitely every year. And it's cool. It's not aging as well as me. It has a lot of cracks in it.
Wow.
But it's cool.
That's pretty amazing. So
it was.
So
you talked about John Shepherd. John and I did a second movie together that year. It was called Bonsai Runner with Dean Stockwell.
Yeah, that movie, from what I read about it, it reminds me a lot of the new film that came out, that Tokyo Drift film.
Yeah, well, this one is somewhat racing, not as good as the drift racing, but it was quite cool to see John again on this, and literally this film was thrown together practically overnight. I mean, all my scenes were shot in one night, and I mean, I got to drive this hopped up Camaro, which had a Corvette engine. I had a blast. Definitely dangerous stunts I was doing, but at that age you feel bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to check that one out. I don't think either of us have seen that, but
it wasn't a big movie. I mean, I die in that film too. I died three times that year between Junior and Bonsai Runner, and then Tales of the Dark Side.
Right. Now, going back to Friday Five, though, what was it like seeing the finished film for the first time, and do you remember that experience?
Oh, yeah, because we did a screening in Westwood, at the big theater in Westwood.
Wow.
In fact, it was kind of funny because we also set up a wrap party, at least the cast did, at a real kind of new age type restaurant. But the film itself, it was a lot of fun going to the show and seeing everybody. What was interesting, all the people that had nudity in the show kind of got embarrassed during the screening.
Mm.
It was like, oh my God, you know, they see, we all were not allowed to see most of the other people's deaths. Like, I was able to, I can't remember, I saw a couple other people die, but they pretty much wanted to keep everybody separate in that. But it was interesting. So when, like, John Dix and I became friends, but because during his scene, there was a nude scene with him and the girl he was with, they didn't let us, you know, they were private about that. So, but it was interesting, everybody sitting together, none of us knew whether we were going to die that night.
Right.
And in a sense, nobody wanted to die because they knew it was the end of the movie for them. And they wanted to keep working and get paid. So it was like, it was almost like a lottery. You know, they would, I remember there was a scene before mine. And it was just kind of interesting, you know. It was a whole different vibe.
Yeah, so
not everybody can experience their death and actually watch it.
Yeah, I imagine that's true.
You know.
So I've got to ask this, though, because there's a lot of people, and you kind of mentioned with the nudity and stuff, there's a lot of, especially women on the film, that have said they had a problem with the director, Danny Steinman. Did you ever sense this or hear anything about this?
No. You know, Danny was really good to me. I mean, I got along with him. I didn't really know any conflict with Danny for myself, personally.
Yeah.
You know, it was a tough film. I mean, I'm sure Danny had a real tough time doing it. You know, don't forget, you know, these are a whole group of actors, some experienced, some not. And so, you know, he definitely had his hands full. And there were attitudes, you know, but, he's dealing with a big company, you know, Frank Mancuso Jr. is a very big producer. So, you know, Danny definitely had to step up to the plate and make this happen. So, you know, for me personally, no. Danny was great. I liked the guy. So I didn't witness anything in particular other than, don't forget, most of us probably didn't have the experience of you know, if they did have a problem with Danny, well, maybe that's how directing is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not too many people had many roles before that. I mean, my whole background came from sitcoms and TV commercials before that.
Right.
You know. But
since, you know, the film, I think it was over 20 years ago now.
Wow.
Have you had any fan encounters over the years or just reactions in person to the film?
Yeah, I've actually had two pretty bizarre encounters. You know, I sell art in Hawaii. I direct a company, two galleries here. And I had the first time something happened to me, and this was, oh, God, 10 years ago. I'm in a little light room giving a show on a piece of art, which is kind of like this little dark cabin piece. And the guy went, oh, my God. He goes, that piece reminds me of Friday the 13th. And I couldn't help but laugh. Hey, I was in that movie, Part 5, and he looks at me and goes, oh, my God, Junior! And he starts doing all my lines. He knew my lines better than I knew my lines. And he was going crazy, and then he turned to me and he said, I got to buy something. I got to buy something. And I said, why? And he goes, I want you to sign it. So that was pretty cool. A similar experience just happened literally 6 months ago. And again, this guy knew my lines too. And I was like, wow, this is kind of weird. I didn't really realize that Junior had any effect on anybody.
Well, I think for people that like that film, they really, really like the film. Like, it's like a cult film, really.
Yeah, and that's cool. That makes me feel good. Because in all actuality, you know, like anything, you know, you put your heart into something. And I truly did put my heart into that to the best of my ability. And, you know, it's like, in one of the takes, it almost went to my head because I had this, like, great take. And it went so well that, like, Danny came up to me, Frank Mancuso came up to me. I mean, they were like, God, that was really great. And my head swelled so big, I was like, fantastic. Well, the next scene, I totally blew it, and I had to do a few takes. And I went from hero to zero in the blink of an eye. So it was very humbling. So a lesson to be learned after that.
I want to ask about, though, right after you did Friday Five, I think you did Tales from the Dark Side episode.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved in that?
Well, you know, it's almost like once you get into one horror genre, it seems like other people want you. And it was nice because I had a credit from Friday the 13th that got me into Tales of the Dark Side. And I had a very good audition, and I was with Renee Taylor. I don't know if you remember Renee Taylor, but she played Fran Drescher's mother in The Nanny.
Oh, yeah.
I think I could think of. But she was a successful actress before that, and a very successful husband. They're a great writing team, Joe Bologna and Renee Taylor. And so we actually got to rehearse that at their house in Beverly Hills. And, again, very cool, really fun. Yeah, that was a real good experience, and it's just the idea of getting killed three times in 1 year. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was a radio talk show that wanted to interview me, who's like the man who wouldn't die.
I know you mentioned that you recently got to see the new, or the Tales from the Dark Side episode for the first time.
Yeah. I just recorded it. It was so funny because I had an old tape of it, but, you know, video oxidizes, and then I don't know what happened to it between moving a few times. And we said that it was going to be on cable. So we just put it on the DVR, and it went for, God, 6 months, and I was able to catch the episode. So I have it now.
So you, what do you think about those, you know, films and shows that you did? Do you watch them every once in a while? And
once in a blue moon with family and friends. You know, it's something that I'm actually proud of. I get kind of nostalgic, and I'm contemplating getting back into acting. Because I really did. It was a passion, mm-hmm. and I had fun. And it just was a great creative outlet.
Now, would you go back into the same type of genre? Is there anything particular that you want to do?
Well, you know, as an actor, you're kind of open to whatever job you can get.
Yeah.
You know, in all reality, it's not that I focused on getting horror films. It was just the break that I got.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't hesitate to do that. I mean, truly, I think any job an actor gets, it's fun. The hardest part is getting the job. Once I did a lot of TV commercials, and I did a lot of auditions, and I was, you know, I had a pretty good amount of success doing commercials, and it's hard to get the job. The work itself really isn't that hard. It's just, you know, like maybe a 12-hour day a few days in a row, but, you know, if you think of an actor, the reality is he probably spends, you know, 150 days auditioning. And maybe if he's lucky, 4 days working. You know, I was lucky on Friday the 13th because I got 3 weeks work out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I still get residuals. It's so funny. It's like we look at it as our little Christmas present that we get every year. It's nothing huge, but it's just something that kind of makes you go, hey, thank you.
It's like a bonus, like a Christmas bonus.
It's a bonus, you know. It's fun.
Have you ever entertained the idea of doing conventions?
I didn't even think about it till today, actually, because my wife said that there were conventions with horror, and you know, yeah, I'd be open to it.
Well,
you know, the hard part is I'm out here in the islands.
Yeah,
right.
You know, everything's a 6-hour flight to somewhere.
Right. Well, there's actually a convention in Texas, I think, in October that's featuring a Friday Five reunion. So maybe we can get you in contact with that guy and see if he's interested in bringing.
Oh yeah, I'd be all for it. Yeah, that would be nice to see everybody and hook up and have some fun.
My name is Amy Steele, and I'm from Friday the 13th, Part 2, and I'm Ginny, and you're now listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Big thanks goes out to Ron Sloan. Again, like we were saying, it was just one of those things we randomly called the guy, and thankfully he was really cool about it. And, you know, and it makes me even more happy. It's through us he learned about the Texas reunion show they're having, and he's actually going to be there now. So
he's being reunited with his ma.
He sure is. So that's a pretty big deal there as well. So now that we're finished with the interview portion, what we're going to do is read some fan questions and take some phone calls. We're talking to you tonight about Friday the 13th in general, not just part 5, all the films. So remember, we take phone calls on Thursdays starting at 8 p.m., 1-606-658-0185. You can call in and get in on Dead Pit and talk to the innovators of Horror Talk Radio. So up first, though, we have a question from Test Subject 24, who says, do you have any opinions on the state of horror channels on cable or DirecTV/Dish TV? I know that Dish had Monsters HD, may have just lost it recently, and my DirecTV has a weak horror channel called Chiller that just shows edited crap. I didn't know they showed edited stuff, but and he said, I know that sci-fi shows horror, but not much worthwhile to hardcore fans. What do you both think? I don't have much to say about those channels because I've never really watched them. I mean, Monsters HD sounded like a really cool channel when it was around. But
the idea was there, but they just, I don't know if they didn't have the rights to enough movies, or they didn't show nearly enough stuff to keep people interested in that. I think that it's a good idea to have a horror channel of some kind, but they just have yet to be able to perfect it. They don't have the programming there yet. And until they do, it's just going to be, there's going to be these little stations that pop up, and then they're going to fold inevitably because they don't keep people entertained.
Yeah, I think the big problem, too, like we were talking to someone about the studios doesn't really, they don't want to back just one channel. And it's, to me, it's sort of stupid because, like, we have, like, the Western channel, the Romance channel, and, you know, just stuff like that. And the most popular genre of all, horror, doesn't have a, you know, just one kick-ass channel that everyone knows about. You know, you have your DirecTV exclusive channel. And stuff like that. So here we have a call.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
Hey, man, it's Steve.
What's going on, Steve?
Not too much.
What's happening in the world of Louisville?
Not much. Just the power going out because too many air conditioners on.
Yeah, we got that problem around here, too.
Yeah, we actually had a bit of a thunderstorm earlier, so.
Ah.
But, yeah, I mean, we're talking to the fans tonight, of course, about Friday the 13th, and I'm sure you're a big Friday the 13th fan, aren't you?
Yeah, back in the day, back in, like, 92, I used to work at Walmart, and I took a whole week off, and I had my mom's camcorder, and my buddy lived in North Carolina, so I, like, filmed intros for all the movies and copied them over to VHS. It was pretty funny.
What kind of intros were it? Was it
I was probably drinking about a six-pack every movie, so I don't know. I have no idea. But my friend still got them. I hope he never brings them out.
God, I hope he does. We got to find that guy.
Yeah, we need to see that.
We need his home address and his phone number now.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, we need to see the ST3B home video goodness from back in the, what, early 90s?
Yeah, I had a little ponytail, but I had hair, so it's pretty funny looking.
Oh, I bet you had like a big J-Reel fro then.
Because yeah. Hairspray.
So we're having the big Friday the 13th 5 show. What's your opinion on Friday the 13th Part 5?
Well, I mean, just like everybody, I guess most people, when I initially saw it, I did not like it. But, you know, I've grown to like it a little bit more hearing your guys' commentary and stuff like that. So it was, you know, it is, like you say, a lot different than the other movies of that series.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot sleazier, which is, I guess, the reason why I like it so much.
Well, yeah. I can't wait to see the new Savage Streets DVD. I saw the the one they have out now, and actually got me a good poster of that recently too. So I'm looking forward to that DVD release.
Yeah, I got a chance to see that. You know, if Michael Felcher's working on it too, it's going to be an awesome DVD. But I just recently got to see the film, and I have to say that it's right up there with Reform School Girls for me. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, it is a pretty fun movie, and. I know we were talking about possibly the Blu-ray release as well. They might release that in HD. So
wow.
That'd be a pretty cool thing, I think, of BCI. Because BCI is one of the few companies like that that are actually releasing high-def stuff. So it's pretty cool.
You get to see Linda Blair's big jugs in HD.
Yeah, in full 1080 quality.
Soaking up her big mammoth jugs in the bathwater there.
And you get to see Linnea Quigley's lack thereof titties back there.
Yeah.
Man, we appreciate you calling in though. And do you ever have any special like Friday the 13th traditions that you're going to do on Friday the 13th?
Not really. I mean, last weekend I enjoyed your commentary a lot. So
cool.
So, you were supposed to wait until this week and buy the damn thing.
You told me.
Well, you're saying it's worth the price of admission, though, is what you're saying, right?
Oh, yeah. I love when Uncle Bill talks about screwing a teddy bear.
he's had a lot of experience doing that.
I'll fuck the shit out of stuffed animals. That's a little known fact.
That's what they call them.
Yeah.
Well, man, it's good talking to you, and you have a happy Friday the 13th.
You too, guys. Thanks.
Take care.
All right. See you.
Bye-bye.
So what do we got next, Uncle Bill?
Let's see here. Rambo fan says, "Hey there, used to be on here a long while ago, but have been busy with real life in general, so glad to be back. A quick question for you. Do you guys realize that the only good stuff that has come out this year, especially as seen on Dead Pit on the Road Reviews, have been practically non-horror stuff like Rambo, Harold and Kumar, and the new Indiana Jones movie? I guess Cloverfield would be the exception. So the question is, just how depressed are you guys about how horror is going down for the year of 2008? It's pretty fucking boring, I can tell you that.
Yeah,
I don't know how
depressed
I am about it, but it's just really kind of nothing's going on right now. We don't have anything to do, really.
Yeah, I think the thing about 2008, though, that's so interesting is just the home video releases that we're getting, the home DVD releases, and you're seeing a lot of that good stuff more than you're seeing stuff in theaters. I think there's actually been a decent amount of horror out in theaters, but a lot of the stuff just hasn't been shit we want to go see. You know, like The Ruins and Prom Night and then The Happening, which is coming up.
Right, M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would honestly rather watch like an amputee scat porn and watch another M. Night Shyamalan movie. That's just my opinion on
that. I know some guy wrote an article recently that it was the hip thing to do now to bash M. Night Shyamalan and stuff. But honestly, the last three films that guy put out, I didn't like. I don't care if it's hip to bash him or not. I just didn't like those
films. I mean, I'm hip to be square, but, you know.
Yeah. Hip to be square.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
Hey, guys, what's going on? It's Giallo77.
How you doing, man?
All right, happy Friday the 13th.
Happy Friday the 13th to you. So, are you doing anything special for Friday the 13th?
Aside from listening to your show, man, I'll probably watch a couple of the movies. You know, I'll probably definitely throw on Part 4, which is my favorite of them all.
Part 4 is your favorite. It's a lot of people's favorite, too. It's actually the return of Savini.
And the introduction of Corey Feldman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which always cracked me up. Like, when Smashing Pumpkins came about and I saw Billy Corgan with a shaved head, just immediately, like, the first thing that clicked was Corey Feldman.
He does kind of look like that guy.
Which is like him. I can't watch that scene at the end anymore without laughing now, thinking of Billy Corgan.
I think the thing with Feldman is, though, is they actually put makeup and stuff on him to make him look that pale, and I think Corgan really is, you know.
That's true. That's not, yeah, it's not a compliment to Corgan by any means.
I was thinking, though, about how many people have played Tommy Jarvis in those films. You got Corey Feldman, then you got John Shepard, and then you got Tom Matthews, and I guess after that, they discontinue the Tommy Jarvis theme.
Right.
Which is a shame. That was like the only real face character that they had
in
with it.
In Part 5, you had Feldman and John Shepard playing like the same character.
Yeah, that's true.
It was a little confusing, I guess, to some people. But.
Yeah, he was almost like the closest to Loomis that we got for Friday, I guess. Huh?
Like, I can remember when I was really young watching Friday the 13th 5, I always didn't realize, like, that was supposed to be Tommy Jarvis, you know, when I was a kid. I mean, that paid a lot of attention to stuff, and it was a little confusing when, you know, Corey Feldman, he's having the dream as Corey Feldman, then he's waking up, and he's like, you know, a different guy, so, I don't know.
Yeah, it took some liberties there, but, you know, I think it worked. I think 5 is, you know, really entertaining. I can't stand Takes Manhattan. I know a lot of people like it. Just, I mean, it's got one of the highest body counts in the series, I guess, right? But, man, that movie is just awful. Not even on an entertaining level, man. I can't find anything.
How do you think it compares, though, to the new line Jason movies?
Well, I like Jason X. Man, I think Jason X is a lot of fun. You know, there's something within, like, even Freddy vs. Jason, like, there's something within each one of those films that I could take away, like, a little something that I enjoy. I can go back to Freddy vs. Jason, I'll watch a couple of scenes that are entertaining. For real, Manhattan just, like, makes me cringe. There's a couple of scenes, like the disco or the dance floor scene that I kind of like, just the way that it looks.
To me,
it's kind of funny.
The big part that I hated about Jason Takes Manhattan, and I actually talk about this when I do, like, the big franchise thing with all the movies, is the special effects, like, I don't know who did the special effects for that movie. It seems like I read about it, but the kill scenes fucking suck for one thing. And then at the end where they have the big unmasking scene, that's some of the most horrendous looking.
It looks like a rotten pumpkin or something.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell that was supposed to be. It looked like somebody just slapped a bunch of white clay on like a dummy head or something.
Well, it was a misleading name for a movie too, especially when I think they only shot one day actually in Manhattan because it was so expensive, and the rest of the city scenes.
Jason Takes the Love Boat.
Yeah, that's what it is. Really.
And but even the rest, like a lot of the city scenes that was supposed to be in New York, that was like in Canada, from what I understand.
Oh, right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's just like the Times Square shots, I guess.
I think that was it, yeah, the
but
Times Square
shots. Here's one thing I don't understand about people that bitch about Part 5. Okay, everybody bitches about Part 5 because it doesn't have, you know, Jason in it. I hate to be the spoiler for anybody out there that hadn't seen Part 5, but I'm going to. But Jason goes to hell? What is that then? Nobody ever bitches about that, and that doesn't really have Jason except for the first, like, 5 minutes of the movie. And then it's just a bunch of random assholes.
Like, that's probably, you're right, man. That probably is a little bit even worse than Manhattan for me, man. I could probably put Manhattan on before that one again. I dismissed that one. I you just brought it up. I totally forget that movie.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the remake, though, I mean, like, what are you hoping for with that? I mean, there's so many possibilities. It's, you know, I hated it. I didn't hate, but the Texas Chainsaw remake that they did, it was like, I liked it in the theater, watched it again on video, didn't sit well with me, kind of don't feel the need to watch that again. But I feel like there's something there. I feel like they're kind of onto something that, you know, with this remake, there's a possibility they can make this good, man. I'm just, what do you got, what direction would you like to see this go in, or... Do you just not care at all?
I care. I definitely hope that it rejuvenates the series. I'm just hoping that they go a basic, you know, they just go the uber basic front with it, that they don't try to go into a huge backstory that, you know, nobody really cares about anyway. I just think that if they make just a straightforward modern-day slasher movie with, you know, some nods to the original movie, it'll be okay. And if you have some decent death scenes and stuff in there, that'll be okay as well. I don't know, though. I mean, I don't know what they're planning to do with it. I haven't heard much.
I'll tell you one thing, though. I'm very happy with the choices that they're making. It's like when I first heard about what Rob Zombie was doing with the Halloween remake, where he's bringing in, like, everybody from Devil's Rejects and stuff like that. I was like, what the fuck is he doing? It just didn't sit right with me. But this, you look at Derek Mears, and they got the little kid to be the young Jason and stuff, and some of the choices that they're making that way, I'm actually kind of approve of them. They make sense in a way, you know.
Yeah, Derek Mears is great casting. Great choice there.
I mean, I don't want to see it fail. No, I didn't want to see the Halloween remake fail in my eyes. Who wants to see like a franchise you grew up on completely go in the shitter? I don't think anybody.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. I know I'm in a different opinion there. I mean, I love that Halloween remake, man. I separated from the original, but it, the more I watch it, man, the more it grows me. It's just I really was psyched at that movie, man.
I'll tell you that.
Sorry, but.
Well, we have to kill you. There's not much I can say there.
Well, the sad thing is, though, about that movie is I think that the best cut of that movie, which is the work print, in my opinion, is nobody, unless you want to burn it and, make Rob Zombie mad at you, you're not going to get to see it. And I think that the worst cut of the movie is actually the unrated version, which they came out with on DVD, which was the one that Zombie picked.
It had the rape scene in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like that so much with the rape scene in there. I think you're right with the bootleg version that was going around.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's the best overall version of the movie because I don't like the second part of the movie at all, in any version. But at least in that version, it sort of connected the two together rather than the beginning. To me, the theatrical movie was two separate movies. It was the beginning, prequel, telling the story of Michael. Then it was the remake of the original movie. And I think that the work print really just, meshed those two together, mixed them up real well. But, I still didn't like the movie that well, though. But
You know what it was, I think, really? It's just one element, but one thing that really just resonated with me was the kid, Dave Farrick, or however you say his name, he was so good in that, and he was so haunting, just watching him commit those acts as a kid. So then when it progressed and he became Michael later on, it's just, I couldn't get that kid's face out of my head, so just picturing, that face, committing these accents. And he was he was human still. He wasn't, they didn't make him, so much like the boogeyman as Carpenter did. So, we'll always have Carpenter to love. And that's more like a ghost story, really. It's like a hyper kind of violent ghost story, I think, Carpenter's, with the slow sort of pacing. And
yeah, I will give you, though, definitely that Dave Fark is the only, to me anyway, he's the only redeeming quality in that movie. I actually thought he did a really good job in it.
Yeah. But, man, we're going to have to let you go. We appreciate you calling in. And have a happy Friday the 13th.
Yeah, you too, guys. Look
take care.
Tomorrow.
See you.
Take care.
Bye. We've got something from Andy Phantom here from Canada who says, I would love to see a Dead Pit on the Road where you guys head to a drive-in theater. That would be something. I noticed on Wikipedia there are about 7 or 8 of these left in Kentucky. That's just a suggestion. The Phantom is always listening.
There is a drive-through still in Stanton or Campton. I can't remember.
Yeah. But the thing is, exactly, do they ever show horror films there?
I know they show two films. They got two, drive-in screens. And the weird thing about it is the way it's positioned, you can see either film from where you're parked. Because it's just out in, a big open field. And they got, the screens are kind of separated. One's kind of parallel to the other one, you know? So you can actually see either one of them if you just pull in to watch one, you can be watching the other one. It would actually be a good idea, but I don't know if they do show those type of movies. I think they would probably show with two screens the most popular films going, and if that happened to be a horror film, I guess they would.
Right.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Michael.
Hey. How you doing,
What's going on, sir?
Not much. Just wanted to talk a little Friday 13th with you guys.
I'm guessing you're actually on Skype because you sound pretty clear.
Yeah, it's my first time doing this Skype thing.
And we got to let everyone know now, you are the person responsible for the Dead Pit tribute thing on MySpace.
I am. And it's my tribute to you guys.
Well, we
I can't believe we have a fucking tribute. That's amazing.
We really appreciate that, though, man. I mean, I thought that was awesome that you took the time to put all that together and stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to see it grow. I want to add a lot more to it as time goes on. It is run by me, so people need to realize that. I get emails randomly asking, thinking it's you guys.
Yeah,
That's how much people respect us. They think we would start our own tribute site to ourselves. That's right.
That would be pretty funny, though, to do that.
Yeah, we might do that later. So what about Friday the 13th, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about part 3 mainly. I think I'm 3 or 4 years older than you guys, and my first Friday 13th was actually part 3. And after that I saw 5, then 6, then 4, then 2, then 1, then 7.
Hmm.
And I think part 3 is just, I think it's underrated in my opinion. I'm just not looking on the right places, but I don't hear a lot of love for it. I think the look and the feel is just screams backwards slasher, and it's real mean spirited too in a way.
Yeah, the thing is, the more I started thinking about Part 3 recently, the more I've started to realize that actually Richard Brooker is probably one of the better Jasons, and that's probably what makes that film really, really good to me. That and the fact that they tried so hard to make it really good in 3D that some of the death scenes are really good, like the one with the spear in the eye and the eyeball popping out and all that stuff.
See, I mean, that's the thing with me in Part 3 is the 3D, because I've never been able to see that in 3D, and it always feels like that part of the movie is missing. You know, if you watch it, you know, in regular 2D, I guess.
2D.
But getting back to Richard Brooker, though, I think that we said this whenever we did our retrospective, that he's definitely one of the best Jasons, just based on, like, he's just got, like, the eeriest walk when he was playing Jason. Like, I think the scene where he takes the spear to the girl's head and walks back from the dock after that always, like, when I was a kid, that always, like, sort of scared me, just because he looked just like a crazy son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
So
when I saw it the first time, I don't know how old I was, but it freaked me out. Just the look of Jason, how he moved and everything, and then the final, when you get to see his face, it was just amazing. And you know, that film kind of revolutionized horror, the industry, brought us the hockey mask, you know, which is the trademark now for Jason.
I'll tell you another thing I really like about Part 3 too, that a lot of people don't reference though, is the big gas station, or I guess it's like a grocery store gas station scene with Shelley and that gang of people and stuff. I don't know if that's supposed to be funny, but it always was funny to me, where like he walks up to the car and smiles at him and then busts the window and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah,
the thing that sticks in my head about that scene is the fishtailing a Volkswagen Bug that way. It was just incredible, I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, if I had to rank them, definitely Part 3 would be one of my, in my top three, I think, Friday the 13th. It's definitely one that, along the lines of Part 5, that I watched a lot growing up. I think that the other one would probably have to be Part 6, or maybe Part 7, that I was just constantly watching those movies. But to be quite honest with you, man, and I think we've said this before, I love all the original Paramount Friday the 13th. Like, I even hold, like, a special place in my heart for Jason Takes Manhattan, you know, because that was, like, the first one I actually got to see in theaters. So,
yeah, I think I really like Part 7 more than a lot of people do, too, because that's when I really remember first getting, I don't know, I don't think it was the first one I saw, it was just the first one I really got into, I guess, where you really start to understand that there's a formula to the movies, and it just worked for me for some reason.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, they're all great. It was all good until it went to New Line.
Yeah, it seems like we were saying, New Line just put too much money into it or something. I mean,
put too much thought or something into it.
Oh,
God. The script for Freddy vs. Jason, I know I've talked about this before, but for shit's sake, that's one of the most retarded scripts for any movie I've ever tried to set through, really.
Yeah.
There's a lot of changes took place in that, though, too, that you can...
Seriously, though, they picked, like, how many... They went through 12 or 14 different scripts from different people, and that's the one they picked.
Yeah. well, I mean, like I was saying, I mean, I can watch all of them, even the really crappy New Line ones, but I really love the original Paramount ones the most, for sure.
Let me ask you this real quick. Aren't you glad that in Part 3 they just changed the image of Jason completely?
Because yeah, I don't know.
Just like this overall motherfucker with
a tater sack. I don't know how many more tater sack sequels that guy had left in him. I really don't. I just think they jumped the shark with that in Part 2, definitely. Yeah.
Did you notice how Jason, like, completely lost all of his hair, too, in the third one? So, yeah, I mean,
I remember back in the days when FridayThe13thFilms.com used to be really, really popular before it became what it is now. There was a guy somebody asked him that, and he actually had, like, a detailed explanation for why Jason lost all his hair. Like, he was going on about the stuff that he would have to eat in the forest would cause him to lose his hair. It was hilarious.
The coolest thing about Friday the 13th's film's website is the message board, and they don't even have that anymore on that site. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was basically full of conversations like this.
Unfortunate,
was the message board.
Man, we appreciate you calling in. We're going to try to take a few more calls. Thanks again for the MySpace page, and we'll try to send you some more songs as we can find them.
Cool.
I've got a new computer here, so I got all the other stuff on the external drive, so I can send it to you when I get it, but... you have a happy Friday the 13th, and thanks for calling.
Yeah, definitely. Take care.
Yeah, guy. Happy Friday 13th.
All right. See you. Haven't heard from Michael in a while. It's good talking to him. So what else we got, Uncle Bill? We got a lot of people calling in. I'll say that.
Okay, Killer Q. Hey, guys, I hope my topic will get you pissed enough to eat up some airtime this Friday. It'll be my first time having a suggestion on the air. Okay, since the Saw series, I've seen dozens of cheap, shitty cookie-cutter horror flicks come out that all have the same damn cover style. That is, muted color scratches and rusty, rotting letters. I know that you've seen them. I mean, it's supposed to be marketing, and snot-nosed teens fall for it, but come on, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know what he's talking about. I mean, basically just a white cover, usually, and then they have, like, little rusty brown lettering on there, and usually have, like, some sort of torture device on it or something.
Right.
That's, like, the latest in the line of, like, rip-off covers. Sort of like, you know, back in the day, it was, like, Final Exam ripping off Friday the 13th covers. Stuff like that, but nowadays it's like the new age of shit.
Yeah, and all these things go in cycles too, like band lettering and stuff. They all use the same font to try to capitalize on something successful, and that Saw stuff is annoying. Like that Carver movie and all those movies like that we got in that style, where it always looks like somebody just shit on a white canvas and then tried to shape it into letters.
I know what it looks like. It's like somebody shit on a biscuit.
It does. Oh, God, that's me.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who dis?
Hey, guys, this is Ryan. I am Giovanni Frezza on the forums.
You most certainly are. How are you doing?
All right, what's up?
Not
you
much.
Guys having a good Friday the 13th show so far?
Yeah, we've talked to a few people. Do you have any special traditions you hold on Friday the 13th, or what do you usually do?
Usually not too much, but I did last November. I don't know if it was actually a Friday the 13th or not, but last November, I watched all the Friday the 13th, not in one night, but kind of in a row, just because it had been so many years since I saw them last.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, by about part five, it started to get painful.
Yeah.
I can remember, actually, it's probably been, we were probably about 21, 22 years old. One night, we watched Friday the 13th, 1 through 6, and it was like 7 o'clock in the morning. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
When we
what the hell were you even thinking?
Yeah, I mean, we'll never do that shit again. I mean, that was back in the day when we were, like, our Halloween specials, where we would, like, have these film fests on Halloween. We'd run into 7 or 8 films, you know. So, yeah, we did away with that. That's not too smart, really.
Yeah, you never feel good the day after that.
No. It's like when you try to make yourself, like, stay up all night when you're a kid. It always sucks the day after.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same effect.
What did you guys think of part 6? Because that's always one that I've had a soft spot in my heart for, thanks to overacting of Tom Matthews.
I'm really glad you brought that up because for a long time I didn't really appreciate part 6 that much, and then like Tom McLaughlin, who's the director of it, sent me the entire fucking box set one time and signed it and everything just because I wrote to him. So after that, I pretty much had a new respect for it.
Yeah, I mean, Friday the 13th 6 is another one that's sort of hated a little bit. I mean, It's definitely not a favorite amongst the diehard Friday the 13th fans for some reason. But I think that was the very first Friday the 13th movie I ever saw. I know it was the first one we rented back in the day when, you know, the early days of video for me. So I always liked it. I mean, it's definitely...
It's Zombie Jason. It's the first incarnation of Zombie Jason.
It's definitely different than the, you know, the ones before it. I'll say that.
I always look at that movie like... It's almost like a comic book movie or something. I guess that's why people don't like it. It's more like a fantasy drama than it is like it's definitely a complete, you know, 180 away from part 5. I know that.
Mm.
Right.
It's just cheesy
that
fun.
It was actually somewhat watchable.
Hey! Damn it.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think that way. I mean, it's more, I hate to say this because we just interviewed Danny Steinman. It's more like a real film than part 5. It's like a real cinematic film, whereas part 5 looked more like a kind of like a exploitation style film.
Yeah,
but there was just, to me, there was just so much fun stuff in part 5. Like, I, you know, the characters alone and just, you know, Demon getting stabbed in the shitter, you know, you gotta love that.
Yeah, it was a fun movie. It was just, I don't know, it definitely felt different from the others in a lot of ways. But hey, I had a question for you guys, because I was just thinking about this. And if anyone would know the answer, it would be you guys. How many of the movies were actually released theatrically on Friday the 13th?
all of them.
Were they all? Even the later ones?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure because I've seen all of them since Part 8 in theaters. And I think all of them were released in theaters.
Ah, okay. Very cool.
See, those guys got it right. Unlike Halloween.
Right.
Where, you know, you're supposed to release the damn movie on Halloween, but because of the Saw issues now, they can't do that anymore.
No, wait. Was he asking which? Oh.
He was asking which ones were actually released on Friday the 13th, the day.
Oh, I thought he meant which one. Which of the films were actually released in theaters?
No. Which ones were actually came out on a Friday the 13th?
I have no clue. I think it was, there's at least three or four of them that were released on Friday the 13th. But I'm not sure which ones. I mean, you can look that up online, I think.
Yeah, probably. I'm just a little too lazy to do that.
Yeah. It seems like, though, there's about three or four of them that were released on Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, hey, thanks, guys. It was good talking to you.
All right, man. Thanks for calling in.
Take care.
All right, have a good
one. See you. Yes, Giovanni Frezza. He's not really Giovanni Frezza, but his name is I Am Giovanni Frezza. You got to remember that. So,
right.
Are you reading this?
No, I've already read the last two. I think you can read them.
The Bunny Ip. Is that it?
Sure.
What are your views on people making unwarranted noise/disruptions in a movie at the cinemas? Mobile phones, talking loudly, etc. I personally think people like that are major douchebags. Then again, I might just be a fuddy-duddy and not down with the hip-happening young people. Thoughts, comments, abuse. We've talked about it a few times on our On the Road segments. Just people, you know, they want to be assholes at the theater. They want to leave their phone on. They want to talk. The people right behind you always want to talk and go on. You know, seems like they want to do everything but actually watch the movie, what they actually paid to go see.
Well, I've noticed that in the last year, every movie that we've gone and seen, there's been at least, during the movie, one person's cell phone go off and them answer it and then either go outside or just answer it and sit there and fucking talk. I don't think I've been to a movie like in the last year where somebody's cell phone didn't go off.
Yeah.
I don't know if you just can't turn your cell phone off when you walk into a movie theater, if like magnetism prohibits that or what the fucking deal is with these people, but it always makes me furious because even if I carried a cell phone on me, which I don't, I have one, but I do not take it to like movies or anything like that.
Well, if you take it to movies, turn it off.
Really? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to spend money to go into a place and just sit and talk with somebody during a movie? Do you just want people to notice how killer you are that bad? Is that what it is?
And what else upsets me is when the parents bring their little 2-year-old kid, or sometimes even younger, sometimes like, you know, 6-month-old, 8-month-old baby, to a theater because they're just being basically selfish because they want to see something. They don't have anybody that can take care of their kid. So it doesn't, you know, they don't care about the other people that are there that spent their money on and actually want to see a movie. And what's even worse is like the people that keep their baby, like there's a few times people that have their babies actually crying and won't even get up and leave. They just sit there and shake, you know, try to quieten the baby down actually in the theater.
Yeah, yeah.
They won't leave.
I have, though, I must say, there are certain experiences, like when we saw Devil's Rejects, where I was actually glad we saw it with a crowd of people because they were actually screaming and yelling at the right spots. But just for every one experience like that, you have to deal with 10 other experiences where they're just people going on constantly.
The Freddy vs. Jason crowd actually made the movie a lot better than it really was when we saw that. And that was absolutely jam-packed crowd seeing that one back in the
And I don't know if ushers are supposed to keep people from doing that stuff. I thought that was their job, but they never do where we go.
No.
Like, I've never seen anybody come in there and try to get rid of anybody for talking or cell phones or anything like that.
No, so.
Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio. Who's this?
Hey, this is Taz.
What's going on, brother?
It's great to get on the show. You guys had a lot of callers so far?
Oh, yeah. I think you may be our last caller, maybe call number 6.
5 or 6.
I love being the finale.
Yeah.
You're holding up the whole damn show, so what's going on?
So, yeah, we're talking Friday the 13th, of course.
Listen to this. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
The part 3 thing?
That's part 3's theme song. I'm sitting there listening to it.
All right.
Yeah, you got to love the big techno disco styling of part 3.
And then,
oh, heck yeah, I still got the LP that's got the 3D glasses with it so you can look at the 3D cover of Jason busting through the glass.
That's awesome.
Well, that's awesome. I'd say that's a collector's item, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, buddy. Yeah, that was given to me by a good friend.
So it sounds like...
You guys love Part 5, right?
That's right.
That was the first one I ever saw in theaters. And I really regretted not going and seeing the other ones before. You know, I had a chance. I was a teenager in the 80s, so I was kind of growing up during the days of the golden era.
So, okay.
And sure would have been nice to have seen the other ones. But, you know, hey, that's what VHS was for.
That's true. So what was the, since you were actually in the theater for Part 5, what was the crowd like? What did they think of the movie? Do you remember?
Yeah, people were loving it. It was great.
Really?
And that was a time when those movies were coming out like every year or every other year, and so you had that to look forward to. And the studios at the time were actually smart, and they were putting them out, you know, about a month before Halloween.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so people were in the mood to watch those kind of movies, and so, man, it was hard to get in.
And I know there was a guy actually just called before you who's actually asking how many of the movies were actually released on Friday the 13th. And I really don't know. I mean, I was guessing maybe two or three.
I know Part 6 was, because a friend and I went to that on its premiere day.
Okay.
And, you know, we were geeks. We got, like, T-shirts that had prosthetic gore hanging out the front of them and stuff so we could wear in the theater.
You didn't wait in line like all night like George Lucas fans did you?
No, but I did wait in line for a couple of the Star Wars films when they were out, because, you know, they just didn't have all the multiplexes.
That's true, yeah. I couldn't only imagine.
That's why those lines aren't existing anymore, because they got all those multiplexes.
Yeah.
So what is your, in your opinion, is the best one, then, of the Friday films?
Part 4. Absolutely Part 4. It's got probably the best of, what I consider the best of Savini's effects. That whole bit there in the last 20 minutes where the kid goes after him, it's great stuff. I'd have to say Part 5 and Part 6 were the biggest crowd pleasers. You know, you heard more people cheering in the audience and stuff that was going on in those movies. Mm-hmm. But Part 4, that was like serious horror.
Now, I'm pretty sure, though, that since you called, and we've had like probably four or five other calls before, nobody mentioned Part 2 whatsoever. But in my mind, like, Part 2 has the best ending of any of the
Tater
films.
Sack?
Yeah. Well, not Tater Sack as much as it is just the ending.
Well, I think one caller was talking about how ridiculous the, you know, the outfit was. So,
hey, they had to go somewhere with it, and you know, that Tater Sack thing, that was their gimmick for that movie, and it worked. And then when whoever was came up with the idea for the hockey mask in 3, that was just ingenious. I mean, like, I do see a hockey mask, and you automatically think of that franchise.
Yeah, and see, they had They had a good idea, too. It wasn't just a regular-looking hockey mask, too. They made it, you know, they gave it a signature design, I guess. And,
a little red triangles on it, yeah.
Right.
A lot of people take credit for that, too. I know Steve Miner has taken credit for it. It's like his idea, and there's been the prop guy that, I don't remember his name now, took credit for it. But
and it really was a great idea, because there's been other movies. Alone in the Dark was another movie that featured a guy in a hockey mask. But it was just a generic hockey mask anybody could have bought at the time. And this one, they actually had somebody design the mask and had it look a little different. So and they used it ever since. I mean, it was that good, so.
I actually had the pleasure, I was going to a career center at the time taking broadcasting, and this was in the late 80s, 86, 87, and I actually did a spoof of the Friday the 13th movies, and it was it made me senior of the year that year at my school, and I was real proud of that, and all it is a simple pretext that's a bunch of sketches all chained together of a guy in a hockey mask who was a Jason wannabe. And every time he goes out and tries to kill somebody, something goes wrong and it backfires on him in every sketch. And, boy, that was a big hit. And I'd love for you guys to see that sometime.
Send it to us, man. We'd love to see it if you have, like, a DVD of it or something.
Yeah, I got it on disc.
Cool, yeah.
I'll
probably
do that. But you guys keep going, man. This is great. I'm glad you guys took some time off last week.
Yep.
And just a pleasure to talk to you.
Cool. It was good talking to you. Yeah, definitely call back whenever. It was good talking to you.
All right, CK, Uncle Bill, you guys take care.
All right.
See you, man.
See you.
Later, horror fans.
I don't know if that guy ever called before.
I don't think he has.
What else we got, Uncle Bill?
From feedback, our resident liver puddling says, hey, guys, you guys have been doing a lot of riffing on Uri Boll. Have you ever tried to get him on the show? I've interviewed him numerous times, and he's very interesting to talk to. I think he'd be great on Dead Pit. Also, for the record, it's pronounced Uva, not Uwe. I believe he's quite sensitive about that. Yeah, I mean, we've known since we did the Elaine Lampkin interview probably 3 years ago that it's pronounced that way. We just do that because to us, he's always Uwe.
Yeah. Uwe Boll, baby, let me tell you this. I still haven't heard back from you since that original challenge, baby. And let me tell you, myself and Uncle Bill over here are still challenging you. We actually accepted your challenge, but here's how we're laying it down. Electrify Steel Cage Mask over at the Mountain Arts Center. We want to have it. We're going to have it. We're going to kick your ass, Uwe Boll.
Yeah, so the question whether or not we've ever tried to get him on the show, I don't think we've ever tried, although Kelly did say that he would probably do the show.
Yeah.
And he actually interviewed him and stuff on video.
I don't want Uwe Boll on the show. I want his ass, baby. I want to whip it.
Yeah, well,
what the fuck, we want him on the show to talk about his shitty movies?
Talk about Alone in the Dark, Part 2.
We can talk about, how does your movies get so shitty, baby?
Do you put the shittiest stamp of approval on them?
Do you marinate the disc in doo-doo before you replicate them and send them to all the people?
Do you marinate the disc up your ass?
I think he does. And he may not like being called Uwe, but he's going to be called Uwe, baby, because I disrespect him all I can.
Oh, he's a devilish Jezebel, isn't he?
He's a devilish douchebag.
Devilish douchebag. Yeah.
He is.
We're going to have to enter him in the Olympic chess shooting competition.
So, yeah. I mean, we... I guess we should just end this. But we appreciate everyone calling, and there's a lot of people that didn't get through. I think somebody was calling from, like, Australia. We were trying to get them on, but, you know, because we really just wanted to go,
yay!
So we didn't get to do that, but call back next week, and we'll do it then. But it's been a great Friday the 13th to call in. Appreciate everyone that called in, and talk Friday the 13th with us. And if you just joined us for this show, join us every week. We take call-ins and talk about different topics or whatever you want to. So we want to take a break right now, and we'll get to our next segment, which is DVD reviews and announcements and all that creamy hard goodness.
Here on DeadBit.com.
Hey, this is Tom Savini. You probably know me as Sex Machine from Dusk Till Dawn, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Just when you thought you've seen it all, here comes Scarefest 2008, crawling with real ghost hunters, cryptozoologists, paranormal experts, even exorcists. We've also invited stars from the House of a Thousand Corpses, the Devil's Reject, and we're hosting our very own Friday the 13th reunion. Make plans now to meet your favorite stars at the Scarefest, the biggest horror and paranormal convention in the Southeast, September 12th to 14th at Lexington, Kentucky's Lexington Convention Center. We're waiting for you right now at thescarefest.com. Just don't come alone.
Check, baby, 1, 2, 3, 4. Check, baby, check, baby, 1, 2, 3. Check, baby, 1, 2. Check, baby, 1, 1. Come on. Come
on. Hello, this is Michael Felsher from Red Shirt Pictures, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Welcome back to Dead Pit Radio, and a big thanks to everyone that called in during the call-in portion. And
yeah, that was an awesome call-in portion, I have to say. That's one of the most spirited ones I've ever heard.
Indeed. So what we're doing right now is isn't Friday the 13th related, really, so we're going to be talking about the DVD reviews and all that stuff. But as far as next week's show goes, you probably heard it just now. It's actually the music for one of our more popular people on Dead Pit, Michael Felsher.
Old Slipcase himself, old Slipcase Sayal.
For his segment, The Mic Check. which is returning after a two-month hiatus here on Dead Pit. And this is basically just a bullshit session with Michael Felcher, which we need to do from time to time because he's always working on stuff and can always bring in the scoops.
You know what would be fucking hilarious?
What?
Like, I know we use the check baby thing for the mic check segment stuff.
Yeah.
You mean at the beginning of Triple H's old music? That guy would go, check one, is this thing on? That shit would come in there.
Yeah.
That's my, that'd be my professional new theme music when he's walking around conventions.
He could, like, spit water on everybody and shit.
That's right.
That'd be great. So we have that plan for next week, and we're actually not going to be having a show on June the 27th. And there's a reason that sort of, a lot of people may not believe this, but the fact of the matter is, for the last couple of months, I've noticed the Dead Pit Studios has become infested with fire ants.
That's right. It is getting bad.
I mean,
between the fire ants
like
and the crickets.
It's scary, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, we actually need to get, and to do this, we have to stay out of this room for a period of 3 days, and this guy's going to be in here on Wednesday of next week, or of the week of the 27th, and fumigate this area.
Right.
So, we won't be having a show that week, but I'll tell you what we are going to be doing. Axelus is supposedly putting together a Best of Dead Pit show. So that'll be that week, just so everyone knows.
Now, when you say he's putting it together, I'm just curious, because I've heard this before, but I'm not entirely sure what's going on. Is he picking out the stuff that he thinks is the best?
He's actually emailed a few people that have been longtime listeners of Dead Pit and asked them what their favorite interviews or segments were.
Well, no, see, that's what I would do, too. That's pretty,
yeah.
A pretty good
and,
idea.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to post something on the message board, anybody, what was your favorite Dead Pit moment, interviews?
What would yours be? What would your favorite show be off the top of your head?
You know, I haven't listened to it in a while, but...
Because you know me, I don't ever go back and listen to the shit.
Well,
that's what we do.
So that's the thing. I mean, you really can't... If you're a part of the show, I listen to it maybe one other time, and that's when I'm editing through it. Usually. But it always seemed to me, like I always remembered the shows that we did with Linnea Quigley. The two that we did with her. Not just because of the interviews, but I just remember the shows in general were really, really good. Like I don't remember anything in particular that was on it. And then I remember the Angus Scrim shows were really good that we did. And I think that the best stuff that we ever did was, interview-wise, was John Carpenter and George Romero. Stuff.
I gotta say, like, I remember certain things that we did more than I do shows. Like, when we did the Give Me 20 song, and when we did the Tourniquet song and shit like that. Yeah. Like, I remember that stuff. I don't even know what shows those were on, but I can tell you that that was, like, the funnest stuff that
we did.
A lot
of people seem to reference the Anchor Bay board meeting thing that we did. And, you know, we do a lot of music on Dead Pit and stuff like that. So, I mean, just people...
The Pet Cemetery thing was fucking fun to do.
That we really wasn't on the show, though.
Yeah, but it was one of the funner things I can remember.
But, yeah, I mean, he's working on that, so that'll be the week of the 27th. So we'll keep you posted.
Hopefully, though, see, the procedure for getting all these fire ants out of here is a horrible one, really. I mean.
Yeah, because they actually poison. I mean, there's some sort of poison that they have in this can that sort of. You know, goes in the air, so you can't really be in here, or you have to, and you have to close the door and stuff like that.
And I got
to
come in before and take a big shit in the middle of the floor. That way, it attracts all the fire ants.
Shut your mouth.
Into one big heap. And then they'll throw a big smoke grenade in here, and that kills them.
So, also on that week, though, we're going to put a new item. We're going to start hyping it up. It's actually an MP3 disc that someone actually compiled for us. And it's going to be entitled Dead Pit Radio, the MySpace Sessions. And this is actually 22 hours of audio recorded from September of 06 to December of 2007. So 22 hours of Dead Pit, you know, just rambling, you know, just the MySpace show stuff, 22 hours of it.
Of just infuriating commentary and psycho incoherent babble.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that we're rambling on a lot on this show, then you definitely need to check out those MySpace sessions. And a lot of the stuff you can't listen to anymore for space reasons and stuff like that.
I've actually had people tell me, too, that they like the MySpace shows better than they like the actual show.
Really?
And I guess it's because on the MySpace show, it's stuff that might just be bothering us or stuff that...
And we don't hold anything back on that.
Yeah, it's not...
It's pretty hardcore, you know, some of it, so... But 22 hours on one CDR MP3 format, and that'll be available on the week of the 27th as well. And it'll be pretty reasonably priced as well. And we also have Scott Goldberg did like the fourth or fifth interview with Paul Crack, and we're going to have that featured as an audio extra on the site. And definitely don't forget our Friday the 13th commentaries. And we also have commentaries on, like, Halloween 6, Night of the Living Dead, Cabin Fever, which
Maximum
is
Overdrive.
A lot of people really seem to love the Cabin Fever one.
That's basically just our love letter to Eli Roth,
yeah.
Really.
A lot of people were actually calling for a Hostel one, and I seriously don't think I could ever watch that movie again.
You know, I have never seen that movie since the time we saw it in theaters.
I haven't either.
So, I doubt it.
But if you want to get a DVD, you get it for about $2 now anywhere.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's enough of that, though. So, Mike, check next week. No show on the 27th, but it'll be a best of, so you'll at least have something to listen to. So let's get on. Let's talk about, first up, before we get into Rambo movies, the one that actually is sort of horror-related here is a remake, which was written and directed by Michael Haneke.
Sure.
I don't know how you pronounce it. Stars Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, Michael Pitt, and Bradley Corbett, I don't know. Funny Games. The rules are simple. Pick a family and make them play.
Now, this movie is basically about a family that is up on one of the... Is it in Florida or something like that? They're up in like one of these little...
They're on a vacation.
Yeah.
You know, off the... It's in a lake house or somewhere like that.
So. And they've got all these neighbors, and they all go out and yacht and, you know, sail boats, play golf, just really yuppie-fied types of people. And one day, they move into this new lake house. They're just getting ready to unpack. Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, and their son, who's like probably, what, 8, 9 years old or something.
Right.
And they're getting ready to pack, and all of a sudden, these guys show up, and one of them's asking for eggs. And this is the part of the movie where it, I don't know, it's just fucking infuriating scene to watch. I don't know. Because the guy, he keeps asking for eggs, and then he walks out of the room, drops them, breaks them, comes back and asks for some more eggs. And it's just a dialogue between the two characters. You can tell he's trying to push Naomi Watts' buttons, and she can start to tell that, but nobody else really knows what's going on. Like, even the audience doesn't really know what's going on. And then another guy shows up, who you think is his brother or something like that, and they basically take the family hostage after they kind of play around with them for a little while and tie them all up, just play all kinds of psychological mind games and stuff with them throughout the entire movie. And then the ending is, well, there's like three different endings in the movie, really.
Yeah, without giving the movie away, which would be kind of hard, like there's an ending to this movie which... It's like they had an alternate ending, right? And they use that as well, but they use some sort of weird technique, which we won't talk about, I guess, to use them both in the same movie. Which I was like, what? Why? Mm-hmm. Why are they doing that? So you could have just left the one ending off, you know, the one that they actually rewound. I guess
yeah.
And just left that off, you know. And another thing I didn't like about the movie... before we get into it a little bit more, is the occasion when one of the boys actually turns his head and talks to the audience.
Yeah, they broke the fourth wall, which is weird. Did they do that in the original? I've never seen it.
I don't remember.
But it's just, it is a little bit odd, something that you definitely don't expect to see in a movie that pretty much plays it completely seriously except for those parts. I guess that's just a way for them to be like, the director to be like, I know that I'm putting y'all through hell, but this is just a movie.
Yeah.
I'm kind of going to wink at the audience or something. The best part of this movie, though, to me, is the guys, and I'm trying to find their name.
It's not where Naomi Watts is in, like, her underwear the whole movie.
She's in her underwear and panties for the whole thing, but that's not the real rationale for me loving this movie.
Aw, you gay then.
Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett, the two guys that play the killers in the film, or the torturers, or whatever you want to call them, just the way that they play the roles. They don't play them any way that I've ever seen anybody play, like, a sociopath character before. It's kind of like if you took, like, American Psycho and you kind of mixed it with, like, some yuppie 80s film. Well, I guess American Psycho is a yuppie's 80s film. But it's not exactly like that but it's very similar in the way that they act, I guess.
It's not like, yeah, I mean, they're not playing the characters like they're killers. They're just playing them like it's just an everyday occurrence to them. They're just talking about, you know, everyday life in between certain, you know, when they're taking Naomi Watts out to, like, kill her. They're just talking about other different stuff. And it's really, they don't have a conscience about what they're
There's
doing.
There's no remorse whatsoever in anything that they do. And they never let on that there's any rationale for what they're doing either, that there's, like, a reason for them to want to do this. Not like in, like, a movie like Henry, where you know a little bit about the backstory. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nothing like that. It's just they're just brutal people.
It is. And I like the movie a lot, but here's the thing. I can understand why the movie wasn't released to a lot of theaters.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's simply not a movie that a lot of people would like. It's just a different sort of movie. It's a very artistic movie. And there's a scene in it that, you know, is a big no-no in mainstream films. You don't do that. And they did it in the movie.
Yeah, we talked about it before, too, on the message board and on the show. Just a particular scene in films that, you know, that don't show up too often in horror films, I should say. But overall, it's definitely a film that was not made for a mainstream audience. If they actually thought this movie was going to play for, like, a huge amount of theaters, like 1,000 theaters or something, I would be amazed. I'd be surprised.
I think they knew that it was just a select group of people would get the movie. It's definitely not a mainstream movie. It's not going to be a blockbuster film. It's one of those movies that is it's just interesting to watch. I mean, there's a lot of artistic things in it, but it's still not, you know, it's not one of those movies that's just overly, like, pretentious and stuff. And
no, but
just wants to do artsy shit for the sake of artsy shit. But I think they probably could have cut out maybe about 10 or 15 minutes of that in the movie and made it more of a slick movie that maybe more people would have liked.
It pushes a lot of buttons, though. That's what I was noticing about it, too, is because you really want these guys to get their what's coming to them at the end of the film. You really hate them, and you really realize that there's no redeeming quality to either one of them. They're not trying to, you know, that they're not going to stop, and that they're not trying to, I don't know, kind of relate with their victims and all that stuff. It's just, there's parts of the film where I was just like thinking, I really hope something happens that stops this, because it gets to the point where you're almost, you feel empathy for them, I guess.
Right. But talking about the DVD itself, though, one of the more disappointing aspects is there's absolutely no extras on that DVD at all.
No.
And what was weird is, like, I couldn't really understand this. They don't really make DVDs like this anymore, especially for art house or, like, just arty movies like this. It was a flipper disc that had full screen and widescreen versions of the movie.
Well, Warner Brothers does that a lot. That's who released the disc. I mean, they still do that.
I just don't understand that, though. I mean, I think the majority of the people that would even watch this would probably already own a widescreen TV. You know, they'd be big movie buffs if they knew what it was. So I just didn't understand why they did that instead of putting maybe extras on the disc or something, instead of making two, you know,
The biggest thing I can say to compliment this movie is it's one of the only remakes that I've ever seen that I actually like so much that I really want to go back and watch the original film. Most of the time, you know, if you see a remake nowadays, it makes you want to avoid the original film because you think it's going to be as horrible as the remake, but this had the exact opposite effect on me.
I think, though, there's different types of remakes, though. There's remakes, like, there's another one that sort of reminded me of that, like The Vanishing, a movie, like, because the original was a foreign film and not a lot of people got to see it. That's the same thing with Funny Games. And then there's remakes like the horror remakes of classics like Friday the 13th and Halloween, where it's just they're banking on the name, and that's how it's going to be a success. I think there's a difference between remakes like this and remakes like that, for sure.
Well, if it is possible for a remake to have any redeeming qualities whatsoever, this would definitely be one of them in my book.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty cool movie. It might not be one that I would want to go back and watch a lot, because it is, I think it's a little too long, like I was saying, but the performances in it are great. You know, I'm not a big fan of Tim Roth usually, but he did a pretty good job in the movie. Naomi Watts, it's probably one of the best acting roles that I've ever seen her in.
Yeah, I mean, everybody in the film, especially the two guys that are the kidnappers and stuff, are great, great actors, it seems like. And if you like films like American Psycho or Henry, Portrait of a Killer and all this stuff, exploitation-style films where they kind of have like a couple of protagonists that you get to know really well and kind of want to get behind their eyes and that kind of thing, you'll probably really like this movie because it's set a lot like those films, really.
Yeah. So that's Funny Games from Warner Brothers, actually available now, right?
Yeah, you can go to warnervideo.com, funnygamesthemovie.com.
Check that one out. So up next, we're actually going to go through chronologically every last one of the Rambo films. And these movies, a lot of people don't say this nowadays, but they were actually not even Rambo movies when they started. It actually started as just simply First Blood.
Yeah. And for some reason, the name caught on, and they decided to utilize the name in the second film, which turned out to be Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah. Your sister's a Rambo.
So, everyone knows the story of Rambo, I hope. I mean, he was like a ex-Green Beret who was coming home from Vietnam, been home from Vietnam for a while, just looking for a place to belong, pretty much. And he goes through this small town, which our good friend Brian Dennehy runs. He's a sheriff. And Stallone, to me, he didn't look like much of a vagrant or whatever, but Brian Dennehy didn't like him, said he looked scummy, said he didn't like the way he dressed or his long hair, so he politely, at first, drove him out of town to get him out of his town. But Rambo, being the man he is, he just walked right back in town and got into a scuffle with the sheriff and got put in jail.
While he's in jail, they decide they're going to clean him up. The man said, clean him up. Clean him up.
Rambo.
So they hose him off and they get ready to shave him. And he starts to have a flashback to his time being held captive in Vietnam.
Nam flashback.
And he ain't going to let anybody shave him. That just ain't going to happen.
Nope.
So he whips everybody's ass.
That's right.
This is how, like, if you ever go like, over to my house, some of my relatives talk about the Rambo movie. He whipped their ass.
Rambo whipped Brian Dennehy's ass.
He got a bunch of them sons of bitches. He whipped their ass. So seriously, though, he breaks out of the jail. He heads up into the mountains around this area where this
Washington
town is.
Somewhere?
Yeah. And he uses survival skills to make homemade weaponry and stuff. And all these people that are tracking him, eventually they run into him. And he doesn't kill him. He just kind of maims him and lets everybody know that he means business and all this stuff. So they call in Richard Troutman, or is it Troutman? Colonel Troutman.
Colonel Troutman.
Yeah. Who's played by John Crennan in the film. And
it'd be cool if it was Dick Troutman.
Lord God. Okay. His name's Colonel Troutman. It's actually Richard Crennan who plays him in the film. And he's the guy that trained Rambo, and he's trying to, like, talk
him
down.
Did they ever say what Troutman's first name was? I don't even know. I don't remember if they did.
I think he might say it when he first comes in, but I don't know.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's Colonel Troutman.
So, Troutman lets Dennehy and all his little henchmen know that they didn't just fuck around with some vagrant.
Oh, no.
They're messing with John Rambo, who's an ex-Green Beret, and he's won, like, 4 Purple Hearts.
9 Congressional Medals of Honor.
Yeah. And, you know, they're in way over their heads, what he's saying. So, eventually, they call in, like, the National Guard as well to get
he whips Rambo her ass. Out of the woods. He whips our asses.
And Rambo beats the shit out of them, too. So eventually it goes back to the city, you know, and Rambo eventually is forced to surrender. And he goes on this long diatribe about, you know, soldiers wish that their country loved them as much as they loved it, was the big line, I think.
Right.
And it was a big, it was a pro, like, veteran movie for sure. And it was actually a book before, long before the movie. And to me, this was always the best Rambo movie just because, like, the story itself. I mean, it had a lot of good action scenes and stuff like that, but the story of the movie and the development of the characters were definitely the big thing in the first movie.
To me, this movie is completely different than what most people think about Rambo now, because that type of, like, literal, like, high-octane, multiple explosion movies that they have for, like, Rambo 2 and 3, that really didn't happen in the first film. I mean, there's really not a lot of killing in the first film, to be honest. And up till the very end, there's not a huge amount of action sequences. There's just more like, it's more like a survival type of low-budget drama, is what it is.
You got to remember, too, especially around this time, Stallone was still pretty highly regarded as a pretty decent actor as well. I mean, this was long before he started doing the movies like the Cobra movie and Over the Top and just the really just balls-to-the-wall action movies that didn't involve any sort of character development at all or anything like that. And a lot of people really don't give Stallone credit when it comes to acting, but I think in all these movies he did a really good job. But the first Rambo movie was mainly getting you into the character of John Rambo and learning all about the character, you know, what makes him tick and all that stuff.
Much like the first Friday the 13th movie, the first Rambo movie was much more subdued and kind of less about all of the kills and everything else than it was about telling a really complete story.
Yeah.
And then as you progress, move along to part two, then you get into the formula that would become what people really remember Rambo for, which is just violence.
Yeah, I was saying, I was thinking to myself, though, before that this has got to be one of, if not the absolute best action movie made in the 80s. I mean, it's definitely in top two or three.
Which one?
Part two, Rambo 2.
Oh, fuck. Rambo 2 is like
First Blood Part 2, I mean.
Okay, when we get into this movie, this is, to me, and we watched this again recently, and then I watched it again from the set and stuff, so I've probably seen this one as many times as I've seen the original First Blood, but to me, this is like the quintessential action movie that you'll ever see. It's just basically wall-to-wall explosions and firearms and action sequences. Just great.
See, I mean, that's the thing. Like, in the first movie, you were introduced to the character. You knew Rambo. You knew everything you needed to know about Rambo. So, definitely in part two and then later in part three, you didn't focus a lot on, you know, story as much or characters as much. Now it was just Rambo was, he's on the loose. He's after some, you know, foreign fuckers of some sort. And in this one, it starts off, Colonel Troutman's actually visiting Rambo in federal prison, I believe, and has a new mission for John to, it's all of Rambo's missions are sort of covert, I guess. So it's nothing that nobody really knows about. And I think in this one, though, Troutman's actually helping out a couple of other guys in the movie.
I can't remember the guy's name, but yeah, I know who it is.
His name's Charles Napier, the guy that, the actor, and he's a pretty good character actor. You see him in a lot of stuff. I think he was actually in another Stallone movie, but I can't remember which one is like a similar sort of character.
Here's the thing. During this time in the 80s, I don't know what it was. There was a big rush to do these movies that all involved that there were still missing POWs in Vietnam, and there was always some guy, and I don't know if you remember Missing in Action, which had the exact same plot, by the way, as Rambo 2, which was Chuck Norris went over to it was basically Chuck Norris going over to Vietnam, and he meets up with this dictator in Vietnam, and he realizes that he's actually holding these people as POWs, and it's his mission to save them, which is exactly the same basic plot as what Rambo 2 is, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was about that time period. People just really wanted to save Vietnamese POWs.
POWs, boys. So, eventually Rambo was betrayed by the Charles Napier character, who was actually supposed to go and get him and actually pick it back up, after he got all the information he needed, but he didn't do that. He left Rambo there to take on the entire Vietnamese army by himself, and of course, Rambo kicks all their asses.
That's basically it. But along the way, he meets this woman who's kind of like a double agent and his guide type of deal, too. And they fall in love, of course. And she gives him this little green medallion thing that she wears around her neck towards the end. And I always remember that because that was like a huge selling point for the film back when I was a kid. And I had one of those things. Like, you wore it around. It was like his big thing. They don't talk about that often. But during the 80s, there was... Pretty much, Rambo dominated the action figure market except for G.I. Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about that and actually did a separate written review for the Blu-rays about just the Rambo boom after this movie, around this movie, because you'd have Rambo cereal, Rambo lunch boxes, Rambo cartoon. You remember the cartoon they had, Saturday morning right. cartoon? You had the action figures. You know, it was a real big thing. But this movie... This movie's just fun. I mean, it's not anybody that tries to say that as far as the whole movie, if it's better than the first movie, they're full of shit. They don't know what a good movie is. But this is a great action movie, and you know, I mean, that's all I can really say. I mean, I really like this movie a lot, and it's definitely one of the essential 80s action films ever.
It's really night and day though between this movie and the original First Blood movie. They're really two different movies except for the main character, but I think that if I had to pick one that I actually like the second one better than I do the first.
Well, you're dumb.
I'm sorry, that's just the way it is.
I don't know what it is though. I mean, I always thought that as an overall film, you know, the original was always by far the best. But part two is definitely a great action film, and the Blu-ray is really, really good. Getting back to the Blu-ray of part one, for some reason the original First Blood didn't pop like the other two in the set, but Rambo 2 was really good on Blu-ray.
Did you just say it didn't pop?
It didn't.
My God. Okay.
You're stupid.
For the first in this, the collector's edition here, you got all these are the ultimate editions of the DVD. So for the second one, you got audio commentary with the director George P. Cosmatos. And both the first and second and the third disc include a feature called Survival Mode, which is basically like an Infinifilm, kind of like a rip-off the Infinifilm yeah. version for the Rambo films, where you can it'll show up on the bottom of your screen, Survival Mode, and every so often, like a little trivia thing
yeah.
will come up on the bottom of the screen you can click on.
On the Blu-rays, it's actually called Out of the Blue Trivia Track.
Yeah.
So, but they have, like, documentaries on these as well, like the... on the second one and the third one.
Yeah, the first one's got a commentary with Stallone and the writer, David Morrell, as well.
Indeed.
And I think
a lot of the extras on these are pretty much the same.
So yeah, when we get to the bonus disc, it'll be...
Bonus!
On. Donkey Kong.
So, going to Rambo 3, which I think we can both agree that is definitely our least favorite of the original.
I don't see how it could be anybody's favorite out of all these movies. I really don't.
Yeah, to me, this movie always just seemed like a cash-in on them because, like we were saying, in the 80s, Rambo was a huge deal. There was a huge merchandise market out there for Rambo memorabilia. And to me, it was just another movie they used to, you know, they didn't really have that good of a story. So they thought, well, let's just go ahead and make another balls-to-the-wall action movie. But in this one, it really didn't work as well. I mean, the villains this time are the Russians, who were trying to take over Afghanistan at the time. I guess that was a pretty big deal.
The thing that I always thought was hilarious about this movie was the fact that Rambo's in like a monastery
yeah.
when they first like come to town.
Well, he's helping build a monastery or something.
Yeah, he's like in there with a bunch of monks and stuff, and he's trying to find his inner peace.
He's
or
got
whatever.
One of those cloaks on or whatever.
Right. And the government comes to find him because I think Colonel Troutman gets kidnapped in this one. And he's kidnapped by the Russians who were in like a war with Afghanistan yeah. at the time.
But first, I think Troutman actually comes and tries to talk Rambo into helping him.
Right.
Rambo said that he's just, you know, done with that sort of stuff. And he's
but that's the tipping point right there, though, yeah. is when they actually kidnap his colonel, his father figure or whatever in the film.
And now he's going to grab his bow and arrows.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to take out the Russian army.
There is one really good fight scene in this movie that involves the guy that looks like Zangief, like the big Russian guy. Right. Who, yeah, that's a pretty good one.
I mean, there's some good action scenes in this movie, but I think overall it just, It was missing something. I mean, it was missing a good script or something.
Yeah, it was a mess of a film once you get past, like, the opening and actually get into the film where he's supposed to be taking on the Russians and stuff. It's not very good.
Definitely not our favorite, but one odd thing about this, talking about the Blu-rays again, this was actually the best looking of all the Rambo movies on Blu-ray, as odd as it is. And it was by far the best looking, but, yeah. And I guess we can go on to the newest Rambo movie, which we actually did an On the Road review of this big bad boy earlier this year. And I was pretty apprehensive about this movie at first because I'd seen the new Rocky movie, and being quite honest with you, it didn't impress me much at all.
No, the new Rocky movie was bad, but I always thought it was bad because of the Mason-Dixon character in the film. I just thought that was a lame lead heel to have him going up against.
To me, the whole movie was lame just because it'd been like, you know, 18 years since the previous one, and that was the best they could come up with.
But in this one, in Rambo, it's actually really good because they don't even attempt to have any kind of morally redeeming dialogue or plot or anything to it. It's basically like this. Rambo is now in Burma, and he's like a snake handler. He lassos cobras and all this stuff for people who fight snakes. And along come these Christian missionaries that want to take supplies to these Burmese people who are in like a civil war with the government and all this different stuff. And they want him to, because he knows the rivers and stuff, to take them on to the village where they're supposed to meet up with these people. So he does, and on his way back, he gets informed by this guy who knew that they were going to be there. I'm not sure what relationship the guy was to the missionaries, but he informs them that they got captured by the government and now they're being held hostage. So, of course, being the, you know, peace-loving guy that he is, he doesn't do anything. He just sits there and lets them die.
Right.
No, actually, he gets together like a squadron of these predator-ish style mercenaries, where each one of them's got like a different specialty. One of them's an explosive guy, you know, one of them's like the seasoned, what was he, like New Zealand or Australian or
British?
They're
from all different countries, I think.
Yeah.
There's like the one guy from England is sort of the dickhead. The group is always trying to pick a fight with, you know, one of the other mercenaries or whatever. And I think that the mercenaries are all hired from this other dude who was there looking for the lost missionaries. So, they don't know that Rambo is like this ex-Green Beret badass son of a bitch that took out the Vietnamese army a few years ago. So, they just see him as like the boat man that's riding him on the boat. So, along the way, though, they learn that they definitely need Rambo and all his badass, you know, weaponry. He's actually got like a new sword or something in this. He doesn't use the arrows as much in this movie. He has the
like a big machete that he made.
Thing that he made. So, this movie is by far, I think, the most graphically violent of all those Rambo movies before. I mean, there's nothing even close. I don't even know if there's any movie that I've seen lately that's this graphically violent, you know.
It seems to me that the final 15 minutes of the film, Stallone was just like, listen, we're going to put everything we can into this. But he was really like, put every amount of money you can in the final 15 minutes of this film to just cause the most amount of fucking carnage that you possibly could. Because basically he gets a hold of like a 50mm machine gun thing that's on the back of this truck and just goes to town on an entire army of people, which seems like it goes on forever. Yeah. He's just killing people forever.
I know. I mean, it is pretty cool. And this movie was absolutely like amazing to watch in theaters too. I mean, it was like one of those movies where you're sitting there and it's almost like it's 1985 again and you're watching like a classic 80s action film. And it was just, I don't know, it was just a moving experience for, I think, both of us.
It was.
Seeing this movie in the theaters. And this movie, you know, this movie simply kicks fucking ass. I'll just say that. And, you know, I was very surprised how well this movie was made. As far as, like, if you want a good I guess, demo disc for your Blu-ray player. I highly recommend this one. I think this movie was so goddamn loud, and I didn't even have the 5.0 or the 7.1. I don't have a 7.1 setup or anything, but that damn, you know, all the gunshot blasts and explosions and stuff, that shit was so loud, like Noodles, poor old Noodles was getting ready to pass out in there.
Yeah, Noodles was having heart palpitations. It was so loud.
It's just a great movie and a great
It really is. Like, as far as the Rambo films go, though, I'm thinking it's like the most mindless one. They just wanted to cram as much violence as they possibly could in. But to me, that's not a bad thing. I mean, it's actually what you want in an 80s retro-style film. But I think if the commentary, the special features are the same, then you've got a commentary with Stallone, deleted scenes, Legacy of Despair, the Struggle in Burma featurette, It's a Long Road, Resurrection of an Icon featurette, A Score to Settle, the Music of Rambo featurette, The Art of War featurette, A Hero's Welcome, and Weaponry of Rambo.
Mm. Yep.
That's the special features on the DVD.
And like I was saying, I mean, the Blu-ray actually contains a bonus disc, which is a standard definition copy of the movie for... It's just a digital copy, though, so you can't watch it on DVD players or anything. People for iPods and stuff, and they're doing that a lot now. And all of the features on this, too, which I thought was pretty cool, are in HD. And a lot of Blu-rays that I get aren't like that. Like, for some reason, a lot of the features are in SD, which I think is shitty. But this time, they actually include all of them in high definition as well, and... this one also, I think, I don't know if yours includes this, the Rambo series trailer gallery.
Yeah.
And 7.1 DTS HD audio. It's just a killer disc. And getting the prices of both of these sets, though, the prices and all this stuff is really, really fair, I think. I mean, the original Rambo trilogy is in a box set on Blu-ray, and you can get that on most... everywhere for less than $35, and that's usually how much just one Blu-ray costs.
So if you get the complete collector's set, which actually has the three Rambo movies, it has the three original Rambo movies, it has the new Rambo movie, it has the digital copy, like the one on the Rambo Blu-ray that you've got there, and it comes in like a metal tin type of thing, but it also has a bonus disc on it. A six disc that includes the real NAMM Voices from Within, which I watched. It's actually a documentary about the Vietnam War, Guts and Glory, The Forging of Heroes, America's Green Berets, which is a documentary about Green Berets, Rambonomics, which is like a brief little featurette about how Ronald Reagan tried to use Rambo to pass a lot of his policies, and he really, really loved the film, and that whole iconic nature of the American guy that kicks people's asses was really, you know, was set well with him, I guess. Then you've got...
really inspired him, I guess.
Yeah, it really did. Selling a Hero, which is pretty cool because all it is like a brief featurette that shows every single toy that they came out with during that time period when they were mass producing all those Rambo toys and stuff. American Hero's Journey, the Rambo Trilogy, which is probably the closest you get to like a real documentary about all the films. Then they got Drawing First Blood, which is about the first film, and Afghanistan, which is about the second film. We Get to Win This Time Afghanistan is about the third film. We Get to Win This Time about the second film. Then you got all the theatrical trailers. All this, like, I think this set is about the same price, about $30. Yeah. So.
And just to get back to it, I mean, the majority of those special features there are actually on this Blu-ray set as well. I think the Drawing First Blood documentary on First Blood, Blu-ray, then We Get to Win This Time documentary, Part 2, Afghanistan Landing Crisis, Part 3.
Right.
So, but getting the prices on those, I mean, I know that one's pretty fairly priced as well, like $25, $26.
Yeah, it is. It's close to like $30 anywhere you go, and that includes all four of the movies plus the bonus disc and the digital copy.
But the Blu-rays, like I was saying, $30, $35, you're usually going to pay that for maybe, you know, a little more than that for just one Blu-ray usually, and the regular Rambo disc, $20 wherever you go. So the Rambo collection, it's a must buy, I think, for not only horror fans, action fans, adventure fans, war fans, people, you know, like war movies and stuff, should dig it.
This is from our good buddies over at the Weinstein Company in Lionsgate.
Indeed. So we love them. We love them. So next week on Dead Pit, it's the return of the Mic Check with Michael Felcher.
Yay!
Yeah. So I hope everyone has had a happy Friday the 13th. Hopefully you can, after you listen to this show, you can go back and watch Friday the 13th 5 with our commentary, or you can watch whatever your favorite Friday the 13th is. Enjoy the holiday for horror fans, Friday the 13th. Hope you like the all the interviews and stuff. And special thanks goes out to, again, to Tom Morga, Danny Steinman, and Ron Sloan, and Carol Locatel, we're coming for you. You can't run for long.
Yeah, one day, buddy. There's going to be a show with Jacqueline Kong and Carol Locatel. It's going to be a two-part.
Indeed. So we will be back next week with the Mic Check. I'm Creepy Tuggin.
And I'm Uncle Bill.
You've been listening to DeadPitch.com.
Back.